Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the 10th Titanic episode of Who's Who Review, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me, as always, is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
Boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, 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 beep, boop.
People love it. People love it.
Got it in early. I heard so many complaints about it in the last episode.
They don't hear it enough. They need the randomizer. You know what? We all probably want the randomizer in our lives. Like, wouldn't you like to just pull up to an intersection, run the randomizer? Am I turning left? Am I turning right? Am I going straight? Who knows? Ask the randomizer. So it would make all of our lives more interesting.
There was a board game in the 80s called Simon. It was like a big plastic disc and it like lit up. And I think it made that sound. When it was, because it was like it had four panels and like the lights lit up, and I think you had to like press. It was like whack-a-mole. Like you had to hit it when it stopped at the right. And I think it made the beep boop boop. So I should get like a Simon game and just put it here and play it. I can expense that on the Patreon, right?
Great. Sure. That's right. Yes. Yeah. If it makes you feel any better, Simon's never gone away. Like my kids had one growing up.
Really?
Like they just oh. kept, it's sort of like the Rubik's Cube. It just sort of always hovers around in the background of pop culture.
That makes me feel great that's still around. That's
so yes, cool. It's like right. It goes like boo, and you got to hit boo.
Right?
Like,
yeah, boo, yeah. That's exactly
boo, boo, you know, boo, 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 all that kind of thing.
I'm going to go to eBay as soon as we're done here.
Just buy one that came out like 5 years ago, not one that came out when you were born in the dark.
No, I want the vintage one. Chris Franken probably has five of them, so I could just get one from him.
You are not expensing a vintage one. I will refuse that when it comes across my desk with my little green visor on. Like, refused.
I'm waiting till you go on vacation.
Damn it. Why did I ever make...
I'm running by the other guys.
Why did I ever make you a co-signer? Well, folks, we are here to talk about, not about accounting, but we're here to talk about Who's Who, our beloved 26-issue series from the 1980s. And we are doing this because we want to just keep doing it, is the bottom line. So each episode, we randomly select 13 characters from the first volume of Who's Who. And that is, again, indexed out of every single entry, which was 819 entries. I counted one by one. I had to take my shoes off and everything. And we picked those random characters.
We love the Who's Who comics and podcast in that order, and we wanted to find a way to continue the show. So this Who's Who review show gives us the chance to talk about our favorite volume of Who's Who in a hopefully fresh new way.
Yeah, right. Okay, I believe that.
Hey, you wrote it.
I wrote it. Anyway, so yeah, I'm super excited. The randomizer gave us some pretty cool characters this, and not ones I would have been on my radar for like people I wanted to talk about, but I was like super excited. And one of them, unfortunately, I have a lot to say about, so you'll have to buckle up for that.
I wonder which one that is.
You can guess right out of the gate, huh? Well, folks, before we get too much further, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of Who's Who Review is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. What did you pick this time, buddy?
All right. Now, of course, as usual, it's something related to the characters that we're going to talk about in this episode. Namely, I went with the Global Guardians. And of course, they first appeared in Super Friends. So I'm going with a book that is not yet released. It's coming out in November. So they don't InStockTrades doesn't have a price yet, but it is DC Finest, that new line of trades they're doing. Mm-hmm. Super Friends, The Fury of the Super Foes, which reprints Super Friends numbers 1 through 26, limited collector's edition number C44, oh man, and C46, that you speak of my language, plus the ultra rare Aqua Tears meets the Super Friends mini comic, which despite the name, what?
Aqua Tears this
Aqua
week?
Tears,
Okay.
AQUATERS. It's like a whole thing.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with Aquaman, despite the name, right? Because when I got it on eBay once, and I was like, "Ooh, what is this?" And then it's like, "Oh, it's not this." But anyway, it's still cool to have because it's a very rare item. But the cover features a reprint of Super Friends number one of our heroes blasting through the television, attacking the super foes and stuff like that. So, like I said, there's no price yet, but it'll be guaranteed. It's going to be at least like 42% off, and it's probably going to read, you know, with 26 comics, it's probably going to be several hundred pages, so it's going to be a giant book. But this will be the perfect Super Friends, perfect Christmas gift for the Super Friends fan when it comes out in November. So check it out.
And those DC Finest collections are really nice. So it's going to be a nice, it's going to be a really nice package. It's a shame people don't have like a podcast they could listen to follow along with something like that. But I picked Power Girl Power Trip trade paperback. So this is a wonderful collection. It's the Power Girl series that came out like the early 2000s, right? So it collects Power Girl 1 through 12 and the story that came before that, JSA Classified issues 1 through 4, which are some of my favorite Power Girl stories ever in that JSA Classified story. Written by Justin Gray, Jimmy Palmiotti, Jeff Johns, and Amanda Connor, with art by Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor, cover by Amanda Connor. So you know this thing's sexy as hell. It's 392 pages. It's full color. It is a super fun story dealing with the Ultra Humanite. Lots of great comics in there. It was Power Girl's, now that I think about it, I guess it was her first ongoing series ever. Yeah, I suppose so. Anyway, soft cover normally goes for $39.99. You can get it for 40% off, so it's $23.99. And it's hard to believe these comics are almost 20 years old now, which blows my mind because they feel like they came out yesterday, but they're super fun. So check that out, Power Girl Power Trip Trade Paperback. Now, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network of so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services and apparently paying for vintage Simons. A while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying the Who's Who podcast, the best way to support our show is by visiting our Patreon, which is, what's that address, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcast.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And at certain tiers, you get mentioned on a show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. So our thanks go out to Corey B., Damian Whiter, David Ace Gutierrez, Phil Becker, Mike Atchison, Nathan Archer,
Gore Tolton, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, Chuck Galetta, Noah Tarnow, Steve Givens, and Tom Panarese.
Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, as we get into these 13 entries, we will be posting them on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We'll have a gallery post there. I'll have all 13 plus the Zooms Who entry. Leave your comments on the website because that is where we pull your comments from. Now, as we get into these 13 entries, Rob, I'm pretty darn excited because there's some damn good artists in this thing. So here we're going to rattle some off for you folks. Artists in this, I guess you could call it a volume, episode, whatever, include Greg LaRocque,
Gil Kane,
John Byrne,
Eduardo Barreto,
Marv Wolfman. Yes, you heard that right. Artist Marv Wolfman.
Joe Staton.
Ron Randall.
Kurt Swan.
Carmen Infantino.
Ron Friends.
Carmine Infantino.
And Carmen Infantino. Yes, we won the Carmen Infantino lottery this time with three entries by Mr. Infantino.
It's going to be a lot of fun. So you ready to get into this?
Absolutely.
All right. So I'll tell you right out of the gate. Strap in, folks, because this very first character.
Hold on, can we explain to everybody? Maybe we never have how we do this. Is that of course
sure.
we get the randomizer, beep beep boop beep beep boop boop. They get the randomizer out, and it picks the entries for us. Now, of course, Shag has done this thing where every time we do an entry, it takes it out of contention. That way, the randomizer doesn't keep giving us Rex the Wonder Dog over and over again.
Although it should,
although it should. But as we're getting, you know, obviously as we're reducing the number of entries, there's less and less for the randomizer to pick from. But once the entries are selected, Shag then decides, he does a preliminary, I'll talk about this one, Rob, and talk about that one. And if I have a problem, I'll say, can we trade this or that? I never do because I don't like to be difficult. And as soon as I saw this character, I was like, there is zero, I don't even need to look at the Google Doc. There is zero chance Shag is letting me do this one. So go ahead.
You're going to be lucky if I even let you talk about this character. I've written a full page, I'm not kidding, of notes. So, all right. So the first character, and I'm going to sing it. The first character is Animal Man. I flipped my lid when I saw this on the randomizer. I'm like, randomizer, you love me, and I love you too. So this is from Who's Who, issue number one. It is, again, we talked about this not too long ago, as we covered Angle Man, which is the other half of the page recently, but it is a two-thirds of a page entry, but it's vertically split. So Animal Man has two-thirds of the page vertically. It's very weird because it's issue number one. They're still figuring out the format, right? So the artist on this is Gil Kane, and I had to do a little research on it. Gil Kane did, in fact, draw some of the original Animal Man adventures from the 1960s, and he also drew the Animal Man appearances in Action Comics with the Forgotten Hero. So it makes sense to have him do this here. And man, look at that logo. It is absolutely badass. So I, you know, I'm going to describe the image, and then I'll let you speak for a moment. Just a moment,
Thank
and then
you.
we'll go from there. So first of all, that logo is incredible. It's is Animal Man. It's all like scratchy, and within each one of the fat letters is different animal print. Like I see tiger and cheetah and more tiger and more cheetah and other kinds of animals as well.
I was like, where is Shag going with this? Because this after the two, that's it. But
The
okay.
M looks like it's something else, but I don't know what. Anyway, it looks incredible. And it's in shades of orange, just like his costume. Then you've got Gil Kane, he's drawing Animal Man who's running at you, right? So he's kind of, you know, his one leg is up like he's in a running pose. Behind him in this beautiful blue surprint is a close-up of his face, is a cheetah. And then you've got him flying along with an eagle. It looks absolutely great. I will say, as that one thing that struck me is how similar this image is to the cover of Animal Man number one, drawn by Brian Bolland. I actually looked it up and I'm like, oh. There's a lot. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but there's a lot of similarities. Okay, you may now speak.
Thank you. No, the logo is boss, right? It's a great logo. Actually, I was so interested in it that I looked it up because I was kind of curious, when did he get that? Right? Is that I was like, is this original to the series? And I went and looked it up, and he had five appearances in Strange Adventures, which oddly not consecutive. Like every fourth
Right.
issue, he got it. Now, if you look at the covers, this logo does not appear anywhere. Now, I've not read the interior stories. Have you? I assume you have.
No, I had the exact same notes. I was going to ask you, what is it on the splash pages? Because I
And
couldn't
that's right.
find the
I'm
logo
thinking,
either.
was it maybe on? It's not on any of the covers. In fact, one of the covers, they just call him A-Man. They don't even call
Right.
him Animal Man. But so I don't know if that was. But then his next appearance after that initial run is in an issue of Wonder Woman in the 70s, and it's there. On the top of the cover, it says The Amazing Animal Man, and there it is. So, okay, so and mystery solved. It is not a creation of Who's Who. It is that his logo. Now, again, maybe they made it in the 70s, but nevertheless, it's not original. But it's great. It's the listing is beautiful. I mean, I'm a big fan of Gil Kane, especially Gil Kane inking himself. I think it's I love his body positioning when he's flying with the eagle. Like he's not flying like Superman, you know? He's like floating. He's sort of undulating the way a bird does, which I think is great. And then, of course, he's running along with the cheetah and then he gets shot. So great listing. Absolutely. I remembered this was one of my favorites when I first got the first issue because I was only vaguely familiar with this character. But I was like, oh, that looked awesome. So great stuff.
He's got a great looking cowl, the way that his hair is exposed. You got the sort of the triangle lenses as well. The orange and the blue are a great contrast. Now, when they get to the series with the Grant Morrison series, they do tweak the costume a little bit, not a lot, but it does make it even better. So it's a great look, and I'm glad that he still pretty much has it. I mean, nowadays they sometimes show him wearing a blue costume, but a lot of times he's still wearing this one. So it stuck around for a reason. By the way, those 1980s Wonder Woman appearances, do you know who brought him back?
Jerry Conway, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. You did so much research. I'm so proud of you.
There you go.
You're hitting all of my notes here. I'm amazed.
I
So,
wanted to
yeah,
zip through this.
that ain't happening. So, he was created by Dave Wood with the writer and artist Carmine Infantino. So, Carmine would have been another good pick for this, but I'm really glad they went with Gil Kane. And also, he was more sort of contemporarily the one drawing him. Now, his origin is he, you know, Buddy Baker sees this alien spaceship crash in the woods, and he's bathed in this unique radiation which alters his body, which allows him to absorb the abilities of nearby animals. And now, this origin will change many times over the years, but that was how he was originally presented about all the way back in 1965. So from there, again, as you mentioned, he had like five appearances. It was really strange across 2 years. It was or 20 months. It was so weird. Then he comes back in that Wonder Woman appearance. Then he comes back with the Forgotten Heroes. So and that was about 2 years before this Who's Who entry, and that was in Action Comics and DC Comics Presents. And he also briefly appeared with Crisis. Now, here's the thing. This is where we get into like, what has he done since then? And this is, you know, prepare yourself for my TED talk. So, like, what amazes me is that this is, you know, 1985, right? And a pre-crisis sort of exists in my mind. Sorry, guys, as like this old kind of stale place. Like, it's pre-crisis. Sorry, late 70s, early 80s. DC doesn't do a ton for me. I mean, there's a lot I love, but not everything. Anyway, it's
Chris
still crazy.
Franklin, you hold him down and I'll punch him.
I just knew that was coming. But anyway, it's just amazing to me to think of where they were in 1985 and that just 3 years later, the Grant Morrison book starts. Like, to me, it feels like there should be like 10 years in between these two things. It's literally only 3 years that jump to go from pre-crisis to what the hell is this book about? And the Grant Morrison series bears worth talking about a little bit. Like, it was originally, did you ever read the Animal Man series, by the way?
Oh yeah, I was a regular reader of that.
Okay, good. Because being that he's like an animal activist, I knew you would love it. So okay. So yeah, the original is only supposed to be a 4-issue miniseries. The sales were through the roof immediately, so it immediately got greenlit to ongoing. You know, it's one of the first books that went to Vertigo. It's if you've never read it, folks, I mean, it's a fantastic series. It's deep. It's again animal activism. It makes you think. It's also very, very meta. I mean, by the end, you know, Buddy knows he's in a comic book. And eventually he seeks out Grant Morrison, the guy who writes this comic, because he wants to understand why he's putting him through all this crap. It's wild. And then as they go further on, they sort of establish that he's tapping his powers. He's just tapping into something called the red, which is sort of like Swamp Thing's the green, but the red represents blood. And he can tap into this energy of living beings. He can call upon the, at that point, he gets to the point where he can call on the power of any animals. It doesn't have to be near them anymore. And eventually he can tap into animals that are even extinct. There's this great scene where he's doing a movie stunt because he's a stuntman, and he's driving off a cliff and he taps into like the toughness of like a triceratops or something like that, which I just thought was like, that is freaking cool. I love that. The book ran for a long, long time with Vertigo. It was very Buddy was always like this relatable character in the middle of weirdness. That's what I liked about it. After a while, they changed writers several times. They did make Buddy into like a weird animal hybrid for a while, which wasn't my cup of tea. So even I kind of faded away from it. But either way, eventually it gets pulled back in the DCU in books like Infinite Crisis in 52. Then Jerry Conway wrote a miniseries called The Last Days of Animal Man.
Right.
I feel like we even talked to him about that. I don't know. Or maybe I just did a written interview with him. I don't know. Somehow I feel like I chatted with him about that one. But then in the New 52, I don't know if you knew this or not, he had his own book in the New 52, which lasted a while. It was actually written by Jeff Lemire, the guy's writing JSA right now. And he's still around. I mean, he's not necessarily a headliner, but he still shows up for stuff, and that makes me happy. Now, let me ask you, why, I'm assuming, you better answer you do, but why do you love, if you do, Animal Man? What about him do you like?
I mean, again, I think I like the power set. I think that's fun. I like his look, all that stuff. I did love that series. You didn't mention that every issue had a Brian Bolland cover.
Oh,
That
yeah.
doesn't hurt. No, I just thought he was just a cool character. I liked him. I liked him in the Forgotten Heroes. I remember I got those DC Comics Presents issues. I will say, you mentioned it, that he's a movie stuntman. And that, first of all, is it that you like movie characters that were movie stuntmen? Is that just a thing? Because there's only two superheroes that ever had that job, and you really are a huge fan of them both, oddly enough. But
Trickster's another one, and I like him too, by
oh, is Trickster one?
the
Okay, because I was going to say that is an that's more superheroes should have that as a as their you know their secret identity occupation, because it's perfect for the
Yeah.
superhero lifestyle. You make decent money. It requires you to be in probably abnormally good shape, right? So it's not like you're like a teacher and you're like, wow, why the hell is that guy built like that? Like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Kindergarten Cop. You're like, why the hell is a grade school teacher got giant biceps? You don't, you'd only have to work sparingly. You know, you're not showing up to an office every day trying to be a superhero. So it's like, if you just in terms of writing stories, it really helps feed your secret identity thing. So I think that's a great concept. No, I've always liked this character.
By the way, I like the movie The Fall Guy too, so that counts.
Well, that's funny you say it. Well, because since, you know, in the recent, I did a fade out on Burt Reynolds, and he does a movie called Hooper where he plays a stunt man. And that's a really great movie. I had never seen it. It's by the same director of Smokey the Bandit, which I'm less a fan of, but Hooper was terrific. And it's a really wonderful tribute to the stunt performing people, like the, you know, the world of stunt performers. So it's a whole thing. I thought this was great.
So the worm has just turned. Chris Franklin, you heard him just say he's not as big a fan of Smoking the Bandit. You hold him down. I'll hit him
I
this time,
mentioned it
correct?
on Fade Out. I didn't say it was a bad movie. I just said, nah, you know, but Hooper's a really good movie.
Okay. Well, the reasons why I love Animal Man, thanks for asking, is that he's so down to earth, right? Like I mentioned, he's like this normal guy in a storm of weirdness. He's like a Jimmy Stewart character. Like Jimmy Stewart often played a normal guy whose circumstances were like out of his control. And that's kind of Buddy. I mean, in fact, he would rather go by Buddy than Animal Man. Nobody calls him Animal Man. They all call him Buddy. That's how he's just a normal guy. He's a family man. He's got a wife and two kids. They actually play a role in his stories. There's this moment in it's in one of the Infinite Crisis series. I don't know which one it is. It doesn't really matter which one because there's a million of spinoffs, but he's in his house, like his little suburban house with his wife, and he's rummaging through frantically through all these closets, and he's searching for his spacesuit because they're going off into space for some reason. And he's like, you know, honey, have you seen my spacesuit? I mean, it's just such a great suburban moment. And then you find out that Ellen, his wife, has actually thrown out his spacesuit. And his reaction is, you did what? That was a gift from Adam Strange. What if I run into what if I run into him? Just like such a lovely, friendly kind of moment. Like, what if I run into him? You know, he gave it to me. I just adore that. He's also one of the few characters that actually looks cool in a leather jacket. You know, I mean, for him, it's probably fake leather, to be fair.
He could have joined the Avengers in the late 80s if he wanted to.
He could have, or the X-Men. So I've been reading this character about this character for 35 years. And until doing research for this episode, I never knew that his first name was Bernard. I had no idea. So I feel kind of stupid about that, but I guess it makes sense. So, where can you see more of Animal Man besides me just talking endlessly about him? And you can hear me talk about him on Justice League International Bwahaha podcast, because he was part of Justice League Europe. Me and Matt Ev did an episode where we talked about Vertigo books, including Animal Man, or you could watch the DC Nation animated short, which is where that little sing song thing comes from. Rob, how would it sound like?
The Animal Man.
So do you know who did his voice? Not the song, but it was Weird Al. First of all, I didn't even know Weird Al. I didn't even know Animal Man talked during those segments. I don't remember that. But either way, I was looking up and said Weird Al did his voice. That's amazing. He's also made appearances on like Teen Titans Go and DC Superhero Girls and video games. Anyway, he is lovely, wonderful, and no other character in this episode will take as long as that did, folks.
Unfortunately, we don't have time for the rest. We got to go right to feedback at this point. So hold on, everyone. We're going to run some podcast promos, and we'll be right back. All right. May I talk now? Can we move on, please? Okay, thank you. Next up, Captain Boomerang, of course, one of the Flash's greatest villains, first appeared in Flash number 117. Now, that's funny, right? Because Flash 117, that's 1 year out from the return of the Flash, the new Flash, because that book started with Flash 105. So it's only a year into it, but for some reason, that surprised me that it took them a year to get to Captain Boomerang, because he's one of Flash's most preeminent villains. You know, I'm just sort of like, wow, it really took him a whole year. I felt like I would have thought he was like the first 3 months, you know, they got to Captain Boomerang or something, but no, it took a year. I remember this listing drawn by Carmine Infantino and Murphy Anderson, where you have this gigantic shot of Captain Boomerang. He looks like he's 50 feet high.
Right.
And then we see him with his little ascot, his little scarf in the background, and then him bedeviling Flash in the surprint. It wasn't until this listing that I realized that the Captain Boomerang is not wearing boots. He's just wearing like little shin guards that are strapped to his thing. But that was always just thought they were boots. But if you see that they're little shin guards, like he's getting ready to play soccer or something. And then he's got him strapped to his leggings there.
Wow.
I love the surprint. The one of the Flash on the giant boomerang is classic. But the other one, where Captain Boomerang is throwing a boomerang and just badonking Flash on the head in the most kind of unheroic way possible, I just love that to pieces. It just makes Flash look like a dork, that he's just dunk and he's about to fall over like that, with a classic Carmine Infantino cityscape there made of entirely of Zipitone, I believe. So
I think it was last episode where we talked about how funny it is to see people get neither knocked down or hit on the head as long as they're from a distance. Like
the back row lifting. Yeah, the back row lifting. So his secret identity is George Digger Harkness. He's a professional criminal because, of course, his group affiliation is the Secret Society of Supervillains. 5'9", 167. That's pretty that's short. Like, he looks huge here. Like, he looks like he's 6'5". and of course he's been appearing in live action thanks to the Flash TV show. I'm trying to remember, was he in the original show? Did they do him in the 90s show?
Not to my knowledge, but more importantly, he's a movie star. He was in the Suicide Squad movie.
That's right, he was.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's a big freaking deal.
So, yeah. Now, of course, you know, these are not how boomerangs work. You know, when you hit something with your boomerang, it just falls to the floor. It doesn't wake its way back to you, but it's okay. It's fine. These are magic boomerangs, and he's a master of it. And we see him, he's holding one there. It's weird the way it's held, the way it's drawn. It makes the boomerang look, I don't know, like I always think of boomerangs as like even sides, but they're not. They actually have one side a little longer than the other, which we see here. They actually look a little bit like a giant bong or something, the way he's holding
Looks
it.
like a check mark.
Yeah, or right, or something like that. But anyway, you know, he's one of the preeminent Flash villains, and so it's nice he gets a nice big listing. It's for how long he's been around, it's a surprisingly short amount of text. Like it's just a couple paragraphs of his origin, and then yeah, he became the Flash villain and he returns to bedevil him over and over again, and that's kind of it, leaving room for a gigantic piece of artwork.
Well, it is Who's Who number four, so it could be they're still figuring it out. I don't really know. Sadly, the logo is very dull. And the image isn't dull, but it is very fitting with every other Carmen Infantino piece. Like all the Carmen Infantino pieces are of a piece, essentially. They all look exactly the same.
Hands on hips posing, including the very next one.
Yep. I was expecting, because you told me years ago that everything Murphy Anderson liked to draw booties. I was expecting,
He
like, see the.
does,
I
yeah.
was expecting little booties, but he didn't. So I did a little research on this because the name Diggers always bothered me. Because I was like, because it's so strange. Well, I had to look it up. Sure enough, there's a meaning there. It's basically used to describe Australians, particularly who are considered to be down to earth or working class. I didn't. That makes a lot more sense given how he's supposed to be, not the most high class kind of guy. You know, he's supposed to be kind of a rough guy. Now, his origin, you didn't mention this, but he comes to Central City with the intention of starting a criminal career. He takes a help wanted ad and takes a job working for a game company, and he basically is their mascot to promote their boomerangs. And then he goes and commits crimes in that outfit. I mean, if you think about that again, he's a mascot for a company. This would be like if the actress who plays Flo from Progressive just started committing high profile bank robberies in her costume as Flo from Progressive, or someone doing Ronald McDonald. I mean, it's just insane that he's wearing a corporate logo costume to do this. It makes no sense. And we talk about this every time. I'm sure we talked about this 15 years ago, and we probably did when we did the loose leaf. I don't care, whatever. There's always a quote in his Powers and Weapons, which is just so bothering to me. Quote, he has perfected a technique through which he is able to use his own body as a living boomerang and can thus hurl himself great distances. That sentence is, other than us saying it on this podcast, has never been uttered aloud before,
Yeah,
and it makes
that's
no sense
no,
whatsoever.
yeah. Huh? Okay.
Exactly.
All right, that's fine.
Sadly, he had kind of a pointless death and identity crisis, and then he had a son who took over the job. But gladly, they brought him back, and he's obviously, he got better. Again, so as you mentioned, we can see him in the Suicide Squad movie. He's in the Arrow, in the Flash, the Berlanti verse. He was on Justice League Unlimited, Batman: Brave and the Bold, Young Justice, Harlequin, video games, Lego stuff. I mean, he's huge. I mean, he is a massive star for being such a dork kind of character. I mean, he throws boomerangs for God's sakes, but he's super fa— Oh, you can also listen to the Task Force X podcast by Aaron Head Moss. I should mention that as well. But yeah, it's just crazy how popular he became over the years.
Have you ever seen The Road Warrior, the 1981 movie?
The Mad Max movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My dad took me to that in the theater, so I would have been 10. He took me to an R-rated movie. And he did that a lot. And he took me and my sister. And there's a scene in that movie where a guy throws a metal boomerang,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
And then this other guy grabs it to reaches up to grab it,
Oh, it cuts off his
and it
fingers.
cuts off his
I
fingers.
remember this.
And my
Yeah.
sister was not prepared, and she screamed in bloody murder. And I remembered her looking at me like, I can't believe my little brother is watching this. I still remember that moment. I was like, oh, because those little fingers just flying off like sausages. It was
Yep.
horrible. Yeah, great
Oh
stuff.
my, I had forgotten about that. So yeah, a digger would be more threatening if he did that. So, all right. Well, next up, boop, 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 we get Cluemaster from Who's Who issue number five. I adore this character. Art by Carmen Infantino and Bob Smith. And just like we said before, kind of the same image.
Hands on
Hey, you know,
hips.
hands on hips, legs akimbo. So here you've got him in his orange costume with his sort of red booties and orange gloves, which are all wrinkly. And he's got these like capsules all over his chest in sort of a uniform manner. And he's wearing around his face sort of I guess you call it like a gaiter or a tube scarf or whatever, the kind of thing you wear where you go skiing. And he's got, it's obviously tied in the back because there's like loose flowing straps from that. Blonde hair and kind of a generic, boring logo there. But in the surprint print, you've got him throwing a couple of his capsules on the ground to befuddle Batman and Robin. Looks like Batman's getting probably a flash grenade and Robin's getting a smoke grenade. And then you get a close up of his face and that enormous Jay Leno chin. So before I turn it over to you, I will say, because of this drawing here by Carmen Infantino, and now that I'm seeing it back to back with Captain Boomerang, I did not realize until this moment that I have always associated Cluemaster as a Flash rogue. Like all my life. I mean,
Okay.
clearly he's a Batman rogue. I mean,
Yes.
I know that, but somewhere in the back of my mind, I always associated him with the Flash rogues. And I realize now it's this damn Who's Who entry. Because it looks just like all the other Flash rogues, right? So it's sort of like how like Rex the Wonder Dog played havoc on my mind because of his Who's Who entry, I thought he was a big deal in the DC universe. Sort of the same thing. This entry made me make up in my head, I don't know, a Mandela effect sort of connection as a Flash rogue.
Okay.
And that's all I've got to say about
Have nothing
that.
to add about that.
Okay.
Okay,
So what do you think art-wise? Yeah, go.
art-wise, I love Bob Smith as an inker for Carmine Infantino. I
Okay.
mean, I like Bob Smith as an inker. He inked Ramona Fraiden on Super Friends for many years, but I love he brings like a kind of grit to this. I love the thick ink line that he gives the figure. So he gives he really I don't know. He really brings something to this that I like. I wish I don't know if he's inked Infantino in other respects or they just needed an inker, but I dig it. The Cluemaster is always one of Batman's like C-tier villains. I think he probably should have. I mean, maybe you know. I mean, I haven't read an original Batman comic in 20 years, so maybe he's now become a bigger, you know, villain. I don't know. But growing up, he was always like C-tier. But I always thought he had more in him because it's like Cluemaster. Like that fits exactly with Batman's
Oh
whole
yeah.
milieu, right? You know, like he would be that kind of thing. And I think of him finally because he appears in one of my favorite one-off Batman issues of all time, Batman number 336, written by Jerry Conway, where all of Batman's like C-list villains get together and they kidnap Batman. And it's like the Monarch of Crime and the Bouncer and Cluemaster, Spellbinder. Like it's none of the A or B list guys. And I love that they all get together and it's drawn by JLGL, PBHN.
Ooh.
It's a absolutely great issue and it's a one and done. It's really, really good. And he's in it. So Cluemaster's in it. So I've always liked this guy, probably disproportionate to really what his fame is, because it says it first appeared in Detective Comics 351. That's a little while. It's the 60s, but I don't think he really has made that many appearances.
Oh, no, it's not at all. And I'm sort of like you. I have a disproportionate love for him, but I'm going to get to why in a second. So his first appearance is 1966. Yeah, he has something like two appearances in the 1960s and then doesn't show up again until the late 70s. So you're right. He was very much a not even an almost ran. He just like never ran. He just wasn't really a big deal until they decided to bring him back and then start using him more. For me, there's two reasons I love this guy. The first is I love his costume. I love the orange. That's bold. And I love that sort of gator thing around or neck scarf, whatever you want to call it, around his face. When I would play DC role-playing games, I would design characters. I copied Cluemaster's mask specifically because I loved it so much. Like I had a character that I think I ported into every superhero game I've ever played, the same character, and he has that kind of mask because I was inspired by Cluemaster's look. I just love it so much. Couple things about him at this point, no one really knows his history at this point in 1985. He just appeared in Gotham, committed a lot of robberies with the intention of learning Batman and Robin's secret identity. They do mention in here that he left some topsy-turvy clues, but they don't really mention a lot in here. And I feel like you said, that should be his shtick. That should be his obsession, his clues. I mean, I don't know how it distinguishes him from the Riddler much, other than a riddle and a clue are a little bit different. Not a lot. But so from here, what happens? First of all, oh, I should mention they describe him as a like, they actually have a quote in here, which doesn't happen very often. There's a quote from Robin. He describes Cluemaster as a walking utility belt because he's got all these capsules on his body that he rips off and throws down. So from here, like you said, he has a few obscure appearances. Then he joins the Injustice League, which is Justice League International, and so he becomes a joke. And I'm not sure he's ever become a credible threat since. I'm sure some writer tried to make him edgy or whatever. But the second reason I love him so much is that in recent years, and I guess when I say in recent years, I mean the past 30. Oh my God, Wow, really? Man, I'm old. Anyway, now he's more known as the father of Stephanie Brown, the spoiler, which
Oh,
is,
I didn't know that at all. Okay.
yep, that's why her name's the spoiler. Because Cluemaster, spoiler, that's it goes together. So she showed up again 30 years ago, and she was her his daughter, and she became romantically involved with Robin. She was a Batgirl for a while. So spoiler's kind of a big deal. So yeah, he's I feel like he's more known as her dad now. So you could find more of him. He apparently a version of him appeared on the Batwoman TV show, a show called Gotham Knights that I didn't even know existed till recently, a cartoon called Batman Brave and the Bold and the Batman. And I suppose Batman Nightcast or Overlook Dark Knight might address some stories with him at some point or another too. But he's a fun character, and I love his look, and I'm glad he had a daughter.
All right, good stuff. Next up, beep boop boop beep beep boop beep beep boop. Dr. Light, the second Dr. Light, the hero Dr. Light, that first appeared in Crisis on Infinite Earths number four, Kimio Hoshi. So it's the non-evil Dr. Light. By the point that this character, but it's drawn by Ron Randall, by the way, penciled and inked by Ron Randall, who was a guest on my Pod Dylan show a bunch of years ago, I should just mention. By the fact that she was so new a character, you could see that she has very little history. So therefore, Ron gets to really rip, and the drawing is massive. Like it's like Color Kid, I think was the only other one that got a bigger listing in versus the text. Now, I will say, this character represents the first time. So, okay, let me back up. When Justice League came out, the your beloved Justice League, the
Oh, international.
blah-ha-ha
Okay,
era,
yeah.
right? When I got that title, I fell in love with it immediately. I mean, of course, I was a devotee of the original series, and it was picking up from that series. And even though tonally it was very different, I was all in, right? I loved it. I loved everything about it. I was like, oh, the JLA's back to prominence with a great art and story and these characters. Oh my God, I'm all in. This is so good. And I was so excited at the idea that they were going to make her a member. Because it was like, what a fun twist, right? Taking one of JLA's most prominent villains and making it the new version and have it be a hero and be a member. What a great twist. I love it. And then they didn't do that.
Right.
They didn't. And I can remember, I loved that book so thoroughly. I loved everything, how they did it, what they did and how they did it. And that was the first moment that I went, oh. Like it was the first time in like however many issues it took me to realize that they weren't going to make her a member that I went, oh, that's not okay. And so it was like just the first slight little smudge of dirt on the history of this great new title that I, because I really thought they were setting her up to be a main member, and I thought that's such a fun gimmick, and then they didn't do it.
You know, I either didn't ask JMD Mateus about that or he deferred me to Keith Giffen. I don't remember which. But that is a good question. Like, I assume she was on the roster because Andy Helfer gave him a list of characters to choose from and said, here you go. Here's the characters you can have. And then either they didn't have anything to do with her or that someone snatched her back, one or the other. Because, yeah, she's like in issue one and issue four, I think. And I think that's it. She never appears in costume except on the cover of number one. That's it. Now, she comes back many, many years later in Justice League Europe. Under the tenure of a different writer who's not very well beloved. But yeah, she is a perfect example of a character that DC had plans for that that never happened. So you mentioned first of all that yeah, the Ron Randall art is amazing, right? She looks great. I love the way she's actually standing on her own text. So like one leg stretches all the way to the corner, her other leg is bent, and she's actually sort of standing on her personal data. In the background, you get her using her powers. You see her in her plain clothes, and that logo looks great with like
Yeah, I
a
like the Lego.
I don't know how you describe that, just like a spectrograph sort of light coming from the center sort of
Yeah, it's like
thing.
a perspective. You just get like a one
Yeah,
point perspective thing. Yeah, it
looks
looks terrific.
fantastic. So you mentioned her first appearance is Crisis Number Four. So here's the interesting thing. So Crisis Number Four is on the shelves in April 1985. This issue of Who's Who, which is issue number six, was on the shelves in May of 1985. So this character only appeared a month ago for the first time, which also tells me that Ron Randall probably drew this not even from a comic book appearance, but just from George Perez's designs because she hadn't even appeared yet. So, by the way, last time we did an episode, the randomizer gave us Dr. Light number one. So here we get Dr. Light number two, kind of nice. So a couple things. Group affiliation says the Fearsome Five, temporary. I'm confused by that, unless maybe she was thrust with them in Crisis. I don't get that at all. But so really, to give you an idea, what Wolfman's going for here is it's like in the powers of weapons, it says with her powers, she can perform delicate surgery or destroy an invading fleet of attackers. Light powers is as great. I'm sorry, Light's powers are as great as Hoshi's mind will allow it to be. So massively powerful character. They had huge plans for her, and it is sort of weird that Crisis gets done by 86. Nobody picks the character up through all of 86 for anything. And then when Justice League comes around in 87, so it took like a year and a half for them to do anything with her. And like we said, it kind of fell apart there. So she's just really a character that got lost. I don't know. Like, you think Wolfman would have done something with her somewhere.
Yeah, I never understood why there wasn't more to do with this character. I really thought they were setting her up for quite the new career, and then no, it didn't happen.
She had a couple of interesting traits. One, she was really unpleasant. I mean, she's kind of a bitch, forgive the language. And she also was a single mother with two kids, which is sort of interesting aspect too. Later on, they softened her too much. Like in Justice League Europe, she really they softened her way too much, and she became kind of sappy. And I'm like, that's not the character they introduced at all. And I missed that. Then in DC Rebirth era, which is like around 2016, there was a series called Heroes in Crisis. And there's a retcon where they established that her former husband was Arthur Light. So thanks for that, Tom King. But when we get to the comments, there's some great feedback on that. We're going to talk about that. It actually makes it a little bit better.
I love that her base of operations is Japan and New Jersey. H having lived in one of those places, I would think that would be pretty startling, a pretty startling change
Right.
to
And
go
when
from
was
one to
she?
the other.
Again, this is all everything in this entry is theoretical because she's only been around a month, right? So this, like, I guess they thought at some point she would be housed in New Jersey because I don't think she's ever there. She like she was happening in Japan, if I remember right, in Crisis. So I don't know. Well, you can find more about her in the Justice League Bwahaha podcast, obviously a little bit there. Then Justice League Unlimited, she appears in there. Batman Brave and the Bold, she's apparently in The Flash. Then there's other animated movies and video games, or you can listen to the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis Infinite Earths podcast. So lots of places you can find more of her, just not in the comics. All right, hit the randomizer, Bob.
Beep boop boop beep beep boop beep beep boop.
All right, up next is Elastigirl from Who's Who, issue number 7, art by John Byrne. So what we've got here is we've got a she's using her growth power where she can grow taller. She, looking at the trees by her feet, she's probably about 100 feet high. And she's got in her red and white costume with the purple boots and the little red miniskirt, which, by the way, if you're going to be 100 feet tall and you're a woman, maybe a short skirt is not the best fashion choice. But anyway.
This is leaning into a whole sub fetish thing, but we won't need to get into that.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even realize that. Okay. In the surprint, beautiful dark blue surprint, you've got a gorgeous shot of her face just up close, very beautiful. Yeah, you've got her lifting a robot. You've got her trapped in the African wilderness where she breathed in these fumes that gave her power. And then she's in the bottom one, she's getting out of, I don't know, maybe a spaceship or a bathysphere. I can't really tell. Some kind of ship. So and then the logo is got it's kind of cool. It's stretched a little bit. So what do you think of the art?
Oh, it's great. And I mean, I know that Byrne later went on to do a Doom Patrol series, but this was long before that. And so I remember just thinking, oh, Byrne must just love Doom Patrol because he drew a bunch of them. He did Robot Man. I know that. Maybe just the two. Did he
Well,
just
no,
do
he,
just two?
in fact, in this same issue, in Who's Who number 7, not only did he draw Elastigirl, he also drew the Doom Patrol entry.
Oh, that's right. He does the Doom Patrol entry. Right. So I was like, oh, that's cool. John superstar John Byrne just loves the Doom Patrol. So I thought that was really cool. I like the logo. I think that's a really it's a really sharp logo. So yeah, I think it's a terrific listing.
Yeah, it looks great. And now it would take him about 20 years till he gets to actually write and draw the Doom Patrol. And we all, as Paul Hicks will tell us, we all re will still regret the fact that he ever touched the Doom Patrol. So,
Why now why
her.
is that? That he wrote what he
It's
did
terrible. It's terrible.
Okay. All
Yeah,
right.
it's a terrible run.
All
So
right.
she can grow super tall. She can stretch. She can grow smaller as well. Diverse powers there. Her origins as well. She was a movie star, and while she was filming a movie, you know, I wonder if her and Buddy Baker were on set together ever. Anyway, while she's filming a movie in Africa, she accidentally inhales these strange volcanic gases, which gives her the stretching powers. So of course, because she can now stretch or grow or shrink, she quits acting out of shame because she thinks she's a freak. Which makes no sense. She's still a beautiful, gorgeous woman with cool powers. Why is she a freak? But anyway, The TV show actually explained it quite better because they made her where she actually would like she couldn't control the power and she would like turn into blobs and stuff like that. But she is married to Steve Dayton. Mento goes to tell you that she could have done better. And she's also the adopted mother of Beast Boy, which I think a lot of people forget. I tend to forget that as well. You know, Changeling, Beast Boy, this is his mom essentially. So it's pretty cool. So at this point, when this is published, the Doom Patrol are dead. Because famously, they gave up their lives to save the lives of a small New England fishing village, just like Rob and I will do when we end the Who's Who podcast. First appearance is My Greatest Adventure number 80, first appearance of the Doom Patrol. Now, she is a TV star, you know, played by, I'm going to probably say her name wrong, but April Bowley, I think is how you,
I
or
think
Bowley.
Balby, isn't it Bol Bol BY? Isn't it?
Yeah,
Isn't that
Bowlby,
it?
maybe. Maybe that's
Bowley, I
okay.
think. Yeah.
Yep. In the Doom Patrol TV series and the Titans TV show, she did a great job in that show. Of course, you can listen to the Waiting for Doom podcast for more. Cartoons like Teen Titans and Teen Titans Go and Batman Brave and the Bold and DC Nation shorts and Young Justice. So she's a pretty well-known character nowadays. So it's a nice entry. It's gorgeous art, and I love the character.
Yeah, great stuff.
All right. So boo 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 boo. Rob, please. Oh Lord, regale us with the glory that is this next entry.
Two whole pages of the Global Guardians, everybody, drawn by Eduardo Barreto. Look, we talked about this on the For All Mankind show back when that show was still going. A lot of these characters are pretty goofy, but there are some definite really cool ones. And as drawn by here by Eduardo Barreto, I think they look about as cool as they're ever going to look. I think
True. Yes.
collectively.
Yes.
Now, some of the, I mean, obviously, Fire and Ice have gone on to great fame and have really become kind of like big linchpins of the DC superhero universe. So, right there, that's helpful. But I will still go to bat for Tasmanian Devil. I always thought
Okay.
he looked really cool. I like, well, I was about to say Tuatara, but no, not really. Rising Sun, I always thought was really cool. And especially Seraph. I thought Seraph was really great, and his backup features in Super Friends, they only did like two or three of them, but they are really, really good. So I thought there was a lot of potential for some of these characters. Look-wise, Jack-O-Lantern looks cool. Now, conversely, his stories in the back of Super Friends were awful. I goddamn hated them. But he looks really cool. So there was a lot of potential here that I don't think was ever quite developed all the way. But as you see them here, they look really cool. I think Eduardo Barreto does a fantastic job on the artwork. I love some of the like Zipitone effects he puts on some of the characters. And
The
so
Olympian, the Olympian's capes really good with
Olympian's
that.
cape and stuff like that. And they have a great logo. I love their logo. It kind of looks like some sort of like, IBM type business thing. It's like Global Guardians protecting you around the world, that kind of thing. So,
Your data safe with
yeah,
us.
exactly. Right. Yeah. That's that kind of thing. But I think they look pretty cool overall.
So this entry is it's so like I'm so conflicted because it's like it's Eduardo Barreto, so it looks great. It's got all the floating heads on the side. It legitimately is a great looking shot. It's like looking at the All-Star Squadron. Like when I look at the All-Star Squadron shot from Jerry Ordway, I get so excited, right? It's got the same energy as that, but then you're like, I don't know who any of these people are, and I
Right.
don't care. In fact, in my notes, you've already addressed it, but I said, besides Fire and Ice, why should I care about any of these people? Tell me, Rob. So
Yeah, not much has been done with a lot of them. That is true. That is true.
Well, they okay. So here's sort of their timeline of what happened. By the way, this is Who's Who number nine. This is where it appears. But anyway, they're in the Super Friends. Then they go to DC Comics Presents, which apparently legitimizes them. It should have Santa Claus then too, but whatever. It could have ended there. This could have gone away. But then Roy Thomas, damn you, and pulls them into Infinity Inc. And that gives them a second life. And then, of course, we get Fire and Ice and JLI. And then you get in Justice League Europe, and they bring the whole damn team back. And to be fair, they did do some interesting things with them in Justice League Europe. I do feel like they may, because they were villains actually in that one. They were being controlled by the Queen Bee. And they did flesh out some of the characters a little bit more, like Little Mermaid. We learned more about her. We learned more about Owl Woman, learned about a different version of Jack-O-Lantern and stuff like that. So there was a lot of interesting stuff going on. But I just can't force myself to care. I just can't. I try. I really do. So,
Oh, I'm sorry.
no, you go ahead.
This listing, it mentioned some of their first appearances, and it has something in the text, which I think is the only such mention in the is that wrong?
You should never say that because you know it's wrong. You could say just one of the few times.
One of the few times. It mentions, it says, these heroes first appeared in issues 7, 9, 8, 9, 12, 13, 25. By the way, you were on For All Mankind for two of those issues when we did the three-parter.
Okay.
And 45 of Super Friends. It says they were first called the Global Guardians at DC Comics Presents number 46. Then it says in parentheses, the man we call Dr. Mist appeared briefly in chapter 18 of Wisdom's Daughter by H. Rider Haggard. So, again, not the only one, but one of the rare mentions of a non-DC comic book in Who's Who.
Yeah, because I think it was like, was it Richard Dragon or somebody also premiered in a book that I'm forgetting about. Somebody did. I feel like it was Richard Dragon or somebody like that. Anyway, so yeah, it is one of the rare instances where they mentioned someone who premiered outside of the comics, which is crazy. And to list all those comics, like blah, 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 all those particular issues. I mean, you know who wrote this entry. I mean, there's no question who wrote this entry. And along those lines, it talks about Green Fury, which is fire. Her powers are to breathe flame, either hot or cold. She can shoot sparks from her eyes and create illusions. I'm sorry, Ian Nelson Bridwell, go home. You're drunk. Okay. I mean, that is an insane power set right there. It makes no sense. I realize that she had those in the comics. I get that. It's not like they made it up here, but that's just crazy. Anyway, for more on the Global Guardians, you could listen to the For All Mankind podcast, where they covered it in depth. Or if you want to hear about them in their later years, you could listen to the Justice League International Bwahaha podcast. And I think that's probably, sadly, the only places in the entire universe to hear more about them is on our podcast network, Rob.
Probably.
All right. Up next, boop. Or can we do a gothic version? Boop, 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 boop. Next entry is I, Vampire. So you've got the eye, dot, 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 and then vampire in sort of a gothic-y looking kind of hand-drawn font. In the foreground, you've got, it's basically just a dude, but it's Andrew Bennett, the vampire. He's standing there. He's got sort of the traditional vampire-y type outfits on, where he looks like he's from, I don't know, the 1900s or 1800s. Behind him is a full moon. And then Surprint, you've got a very sketchy image of him, like blood running down his cheeks as he's been drinking blood. You've got him kissing a woman. You've got him battling other vampires. And then you see his death, actually, in the very bottom one. Art is by Tom Sutton and Dick Giordano. So what do you think of the art here, buddy?
Eh. And I love Tom Sutton, and I love Dick Giordano, although Dick Giordano just inked it. But layout wise, this is pretty. And I always really liked I, Vampire. When his appearances in House of Mystery, a lot of times have these Joe Kubert covers, which are fantastic. They're so beautiful. They're so atmospheric. And this one, he's just standing there, kind of off to the side. I love Tom Sutton, great artist. I just think this is kind of a little bit of a miss in terms of the design of it. I there's nothing, he's not like doing like a Dracula pose, you know, like he's got his cape out, like he's just, and the way his body language, he looks like he's kind of like, well, leave me alone, everybody, kind of off here to the side. It's like me at a party, you know. It just doesn't, I don't know.
But he's got like Rob Liefeld leg syndrome too. Look how long those legs are compared to the rest of his body. Yeah. I mean, that proportion's out of whack. And the Surprint's kind of cool because it's very sketchy. Very sketchy style. And again, you see him battling the vampires. You see him melting in the bottom when someone's kissing his head as he's dying. It's pretty cool. So his history. Oh, I love the logo though. By the way, it looks great. Was that
which
the logo
from the comic? Which is from his appearances. Cool. Yeah.
So the story is 400 years ago, he's bitten by a vampire, and he's had to live as a vampire since. However, he swore not to kill any humans. So he's just been drinking the blood of animals and eventually like drinking bottled blood from hospitals and stuff like that. He did turn one person into another vampire, though. It was his beloved woman named Mary. Unfortunately, she fully embraced the evil vampire life. And he battles her and her blood red moon cult for 400 years. Eventually, Bennett and his allies, they do defeat Mary in the 1980s, but Bennett ends up dying. Really, it's more like a blessing. He finally knows peace at last after they defeat Mary. So his first appearance was in late 1980. I thought he was an older character than that. I didn't realize it was as so recent as 1980.
Yeah, he's a creation of James and Mateus, I believe.
Oh, okay. All right. I didn't realize. I knew Greenberg the vampire was. I didn't know that he was. Okay.
No, I think JM was the first guy to write it.
So one of the nice things I like about this entry is it tells you basically his whole story, because his story was done being told. You get a beginning, a middle, and an end in here in the Who's Who entry. So you learn everything about it, and it ends with his death. He only had about 24 appearances in House of Mystery. So here's the thing. Every time we talk about I, Vampire, and we've done it a couple times now here and there, the same comments come from everyone online. They all say we should check out the new 52 stories of iVampire. I don't know if you remember. Everyone has told us this over and over and over. So, in preparation for this episode, I went ahead and did it. I used my DC Unlimited account, or DC Infinite, whatever it's called, and I read the first six issues of iVampire from the New 52, and holy crap, they were damn good. They were really good. And like that origin I just described to you of the Andrew Bennett's life, they didn't change a thing. Like it's all the same exact story. Mary and drinking bottled blood and, you know, fighting the Red Moon cult, all of it. They didn't change a bit. They're very faithful to it. It just takes place in modern time, you know, and at that point it was 2011 rather than, you know, 1980, whatever. So he's not dressed like this. He's dressed in like, you know, just a t-shirt and pants or whatever, but it's really freaking good. It's like reading a Vertigo book. It's that good. Highly recommend it. I've read the first six issues. I plan on reading more. I really enjoyed it. And I'll tell you, it's funny, as I read that, I'm thinking, you know, this came out in 2011. This comic was being published the entire, you know, as early as when we started podcasting together.
That's right.
And so we are over here wasting our time talking about Aquaman and the others when we could have been reading iVampire. So shame on us for that. So it's a really good book. And I think you guys, if you haven't read it, it's worth definitely worth checking out. And again, I'm glad to see it was so faithful to the original story here. So,
right.
all right. Give me a randomizer, Rob. Give me
Beep, boop,
a.
beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, boop.
There we go. Nicely done. Very futuristic because we're talking about the 30th century now, folks. We're talking about Nemesis Kid, art here by Kurt Swan and wow, I hit the right button there for you. Kurt Swan and Kyle Baker. So this is continuing a trend we saw last time. Now this is issue 16 of Who's Who, I should mention. Last time we mentioned because there was a Kurt Swan and Kurt Swan drawn Superman inked by John Byrne. So this is Kurt Swan drawn Nemesis Kid inked by Kyle Baker. What a weird
What a
combination.
combo.
And I would say artistically it works. The biggest holdback, honestly, is Kurt Swan's designs here. Sorry, Chris. Because Nemesis Kid, he's there in his traditional costume. It's very, very Silver Age, like green trunks, green boots, yellow leggings, whatever, with a big pop collar. But he's just got one hand raised in the air, one arm out. Like I think he's like, you know, when you were a kid and you had to ride your bike and you had to do like hand turn signals for like left and right. I think that's
Sure.
what he's doing here.
Oh, see, I always took it like he's doing like ta-da. That's what he's doing. I love that pose. It's like he's Ed Sullivan and he's like, "Hey, everybody, the Beatles," and he's making them on. It's such a goofy pose, but I love it. And surprisingly, Kyle Baker works as an inker for Kurt Swan. He brings kind of a real energy and passion to it. I love the punch that Nemesis Kid is throwing. It's got some real kind of like grit to it. I would not think this would work at all, but I think it kind of does.
And that's kind of what I was trying to say was like Kyle Baker looks great over Kurt Swan. It's just the layout isn't that exciting, is my issue. But yeah, in the background you get a close up of his face. You see him going for the Legion tryouts. You see that battle. You do see him, and I'll talk about it in a minute, laying a hella punch on someone, and I'll explain what that is in a moment. And it's kind of fun. So the deal here is that Nemesis Kid comes from this alchemist planet, and they use alchemy to give themselves power. So he gave himself this unique ability, which allows him to adapt to whatever powers are needed to defeat a single opponent, which means like a nemesis power, which basically means like whatever powers he needs to beat you, he's going to get. So that's kind of how it works. So he's your nemesis for everyone. And he joins the Legion, but it turns out he is secretly a traitor. So they figure that out. They boot him out. Later on, he ends up as the leader of the Legion of Supervillains. But that image in the bottom corner there, Rob, where he's punching the shaz out of someone, is his famous moment. In single combat, Nemesis Kid mortally wounded Karate Kid. So, like,
Oh,
he
okay.
killed him. He killed Karate Kid. He died. Karate Kid died of the injuries. Like, you remember the Karate Kid had his own series in the 70s, right? Yeah, this is the guy that killed him. And Karate Kid's wife, which was Queen Projectra, she personally executes Nemesis Kid in response to this. Like this is hardcore brutal stuff for a kid's comic. Like she didn't just beat him up, she freaking executes him. So this was in 1984, by the way. This is one of Dr. Ange's favorite moments. He always talks about it, so I had to mention him there. But that's why he's beat that's why that hit to Karate Kid is so brutal, is he's killing him. So he first appears in 1966, but again, he doesn't really get an interesting moment until 1984, as far as I'm concerned. He did have a brief appearance on the Legion of Superheroes cartoon, and of course he's Legion of Super Bloggers documented his activities quite a bit too. And I know how big of a Legion fan you are, so you're probably gonna run right out and read these.
Yeah, I was like, what? Who is this? Okay, fine, whatever.
All right. Up next is the German. Boop, 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 boop.
Wow.
Yeah, that was awful.
Wow, that's just culturally insensitive.
You're not wrong.
Plasmus, the villain from The Brotherhood of Evil, first appeared in New Teen Titans number 14, drawn by the famous team of Marv Wolfman and George Perez. Look, obviously, this was DC just having a laugh and allowing Marv Wolfman to draw a listing of one of his characters because they were like, what the hell? Why not? Right? And the way you make sure that it looks printable is that you get George Perez to ink it.
Well, you also give him a character that's just like walking plasma, so you don't have to really worry about getting it right.
He looks like Pizza the Hut from Spaceballs is what he looks like, except he's in these little trunks. It's not like the pose is okay. It's kind of he's just sort of like, but the big goopy face in the back isn't bad. And then the really gruesome thing of Kid Flash running right through him, I think is great. And then we see him turning into Plasmus in the background there. So, I kind of like that they did this. That they just sort of said, let's give Marv Wolfman a page. What the hell is the difference?
But I wasn't Marv an artist at one point in his life, like you
Was he?
aspire. Well,
I don't know about that.
maybe I'm getting confused with somebody else. So I thought
Okay.
at one point he had been an aspiring artist and realized he couldn't draw, so he did. Maybe I'm confused on that. Either way, my only and I love the logo too. My only criticism of the piece is just like, hey Marv, it needed more surprint stuff. That's all. That's my only
Yeah, it's
criticism.
a
There's a
little,
lot of white space.
yeah.
But it looks fine. It looks fun. And again, George Perez, maybe he did all the heavy lifting here. I don't know. But it looks, it's a, if I didn't notice the names, I would have thought it was perfectly fine.
Yeah. Again, you get Perez to ink it. That way you're guaranteeing like, okay, this is gonna look printable because he's gonna bring all of his professionalism to it and stuff like that. So, and Wolfman was the co-creator of the character, so that's fun. Like I said, he's got, he has this sort of like, he looks like Clayface. He looks like a big pink version of Clayface. But I mean, he was mining, the character was mining, he'd been working on highly radioactive radium, which, as we all know, gives you superpowers. And his real name is Otto von Ferth. By the way, we're in the rainy season here in Florida, and which means it rains every day for like an hour and then not again. And we get a lot of lightning. And my wife is always saying, be careful, there's lightning bolts. And I'm like, hey, if comic books have lied to me, I'm going to get superpowers if I get hit by lightning. I don't know what the problem is. But anyway, he's subjected to experimentation and he goes through this chemical testing, which results in this massive mutation, which turns him into Plasmus.
So, like, I wonder because General Zol did this to him. Like, he barely survives the cave-in for 7 days, exposed to the radiation, and that probably would have been the end of it. Then General Zol does the experiments on him, turning him into the goop. Like, I'd be seriously pissed. This is like a nasty origin, and I should remember this character, but I really don't remember his personality. Like, what's his? Do you remember his mental state? Is he mindless, or is I think he speaks in like a German accent or
Yeah,
something?
no,
Doesn't
I don't think he was like a mindless
he? Okay,
monster. I think he was, sentient.
He should have been like super resentful and like super hated like General Zol. He shouldn't have been like happy with to be in this condition. It's just freaking gross, man. First appearance is 1981 in New Teen Titans number 14. His powers, basically anything he touches dies a fiery death. He reduces living matter to protoplasm. That sucks. I mean, like you can't read a book. You can't like sit on a couch. How do you eat? Like, I mean, there's nothing that works for this guy. So I'd be angry. Of course, you can. He showed up on Teen Titans cartoons, and Young Justice, and video games, all kinds of places. I don't know that he's a breakout star, but he's been
No,
around.
he's not even remotely. No.
He's appeared in a few places at least.
Yeah.
Now, up next, boop, 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 a real breakout star here actually is Power Girl. So here we've got this is Who's Who issue number 18. So you've got Power Girl drawn by Joe Staton. They got the logo from I'm pretty sure her showcase appearances, I think, is where that comes from. A very cartoony, very buxom version of Power Girl as you would expect from Joe Staton in this era. She's wearing not the boob window costume, but the other one she was famous for back then with like the deep scoop neck with a traditional sort of white. One piece bathing suit sort of thing, and the blue boots and blue gloves and red cape, and sort of the Dorothy Hamill hair kind of thing. What's going on there?
And she's flying at you. Then in the Serpent, you've got a beautiful shot of her face. And then you've got three little shots of her in action. There's like one flying over city, one battling a machine, and one being trapped by a machine. Nothing really specific. Like, I couldn't point to any of those and say that's from a particular adventure. There's no Krypton references in it. But anyway, it's a nice picture. A face is a little off on the actual Power Girl pose. Like the
It's very
Serpent,
cartoony. It's very
yeah.
cartoony. Yeah.
It's got like a doe face kind of thing going
Yeah,
on.
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So her origin, it's very interesting here because, again, this came out in Who's Who 18, which was May 1986. So it's 5 months after Crisis is over. But they still list everything as if she's from Earth 2, the Earth 2 Krypton origin. Like, it hasn't missed a beat. The only reference here, it says, with the recent merging of Infinite Earths, it's unclear what her future plans will be. They also could have said unclear what her origin is going to be as well if they really wanted. But so her first appearance is All-Star Comics number 58 from the 1970s revival. She was created by Jerry Conway, or co-created, I should say. Again, she is the Earth 2 Supergirl. The bottom line is she is Supergirl just from Earth 2. The only real difference is she arrived on Earth at age 20 and with a big chip on her shoulder. I mean, that's really it. There is a legend that Wally Wood would draw her boobs bigger, and let's just talk
Yes.
about it. So there's a legend that Wally Wood would draw her boobs bigger and bigger every issue until the editors caught on. Supposedly that went for 7 or 8 issues. However, I've been reading, interestingly enough, there's a different side of the story now. Nowadays, folks are claiming that that's just a legend. And if you go back and look at those early issues, it's not true that her figure was like that from the start. I have not gone back and double-checked myself. I will tell you, Bart Sears clearly took that legend to heart and made her boobs bigger and bigger and bigger and justly gear up and got in trouble with his editor for doing that. Then, of course, she's also famous for having the boob window. And they've done a few things in the comics to explain that. And I know I'm going straight after the boobs, but I mean, come on, that's what everyone knows her for, right? In the comics, they explained the boob window a few different ways. One, she said, hey, I'm showing that I'm female and I'm healthy and there's nothing wrong with that. And then at other points, she said she did it to distract males. Then there was the idea that it's the symbol pending idea, meaning that she didn't feel like she was worthy of the Superman S shield, so she's just leaving a gap there, so she figured out the symbol for it. There was a time in 1977, though, where apparently Jeanette Kahn ordered the boob window to be closed. They said it was sexist, which is, I guess, is why we see her in the scoop neck version so often. I actually prefer the scoop neck version, like we're looking at here. This is the costume I prefer for her. Even though I love the yellow and the golden white one, I think this is the best costume for her right here. Now, the thing that blows my mind about this character is, I mean, she is a breakout star. I mean, I think in the comics, it's fair to say everyone knows who she is, right? She is a big breakout star, but she is literally a duplicate of another character. She's not even like from the Superman family. She is literally Supergirl, and they just kept the duplicate around. I can't think of another character that is literally the same character that is equally as popular that one of the companies just kept around. Am I forgetting someone? Like, are there two Tony Starks running around somewhere, or two? I don't know of that. I can't think of one. You got anything?
No, but I mean, it could it be that because she was sort of locked into a personality from the beginning, as opposed to Supergirl, which kind of bopped around, that helped her gain a footing because it was like, okay, people know who she is, as opposed to Supergirl a little bit, where you're like, wait, she's a this, she's a that, you know. But Power Girl was always Power Girl. Like, she always had a persona from the very beginning. She was kind of a smart ass, very confident sort of thing. I mean, obviously, setting aside the whole thing with the crazy origins. But like, she would show up in the JLA JSA team ups, and your boy Firestorm would always hit on her, and she's always like, move on, kid, you know, and stuff like that. So I think that helped, you know, kind of cement her as a character, because you could sort of like, oh, I know who that is.
Yeah, and she was always fighting with Wildcat too. Like, and she was a positive, women's lib type character back then. Whether you agree with how she was portrayed or not, that was an effort from DC to give a positive spin on women's independence in the 70s. And in the origins thing, you know, it's so frustrating what happens is where she gets the Atlantean origin and then it's all messed up for years and all. I mean, it would have been so much simpler if they just said she's not from Krypton, she's from Daxam, which was where like Mon-El's from. And it would have been done. They wouldn't have had to do another thing. But they just got it more convoluted, more convoluted, and more convoluted, to the point where they did revert to it and just say, yep, nope, she is from Earth 2. She is the Earth 2 Supergirl. And that's what she is now. She's from a parallel world. So now they have some, I don't know if you've heard about this. They've done some changes very recently in the last couple of years to try and separate her from
Supergirl some. Like, they've changed her name. Her name's not Kara anymore. I mean, they didn't retroactively change her name. She has chosen to take on a new name to be more independent of Supergirl. So rather than being Kara, she's now going by the name Paige, which is like short for PG, like Power Girl. She's taking the
Okay.
name, which is,
It's not the worst
conceptually.
thing I've ever heard, actually.
Exactly. But they've also kind of given her some mental powers, and she's
Oh,
teamed.
no. Oh,
Exactly.
no,
This is going
no,
downhill quick. And she's teamed up with
no,
Lilith now. They're kind of like
no.
counselors for
Okay.
people.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's pretty much universally disliked what they're doing with her right now. I'm sure there's a few fans out there, but for the most part, all old school fans are like, what the hell are you doing to Power Girl? So I feel pretty confident in a couple of years, once this writer team is gone, that this will just be swept under the rug and she'll be back to what she's always been. But you can find more of her on Justice League Unlimited. Did an episode where they called her Galatea, but they basically it was her. You sort of course, you can listen to the JLU cast about that. She was on. They had a version of her on Smallville, on DC Superhero Girls, animated movies, video games. Our buddy Symbol Pending has the blog all about Power Girl. You know that you can hear her on the Earth 2 podcast, World on Fire, an All Star Squadron podcast. Barry Reese has an Infinity Inc. Tumblr. You know she was tied up with Skartaris for a while, so you can listen to Warlord Worlds or my own JLI podcast because she was in the Justice League Europe. Or eventually we'll be talking about her on JSA in the 2000s once JSA in the 90s becomes that. But there's a quick story. I know I've told this before. I don't care. It's always funny. So I bought all those DVD direct to DVD animated movies when DC was putting those out, in the 2000s. And there's one called Superman Batman Public Enemies, which was based on the one drawn by Ed McGuinness. And I had that and I loved it and whatever and just sat at the house. So one day I was out. I don't know what I was doing. I was out, whatever. And I come home and my stepson has gotten out Superman Batman Public Enemies and he's watching it on TV. My wife, I guess, is watching it with him, whatever. She's probably not paying attention much, but something caught her attention. So I get home, I open the door. Literally, I've unlocked the door. I've opened it. I've got maybe one leg inside the room. Her head whips at me like, I don't know, like the Exorcist or something, like looks at me and with his evil narrowed eyes, she goes, "Who the hell is Power Girl? And why do they draw her like that?" And I'm like, "Hi, nice to see you too." So, yeah, Power Girl got me in trouble with my wife. So, thank you.
The odds that she will end up in a DC movie, I think, is pretty slim because they're pushing Supergirl
Yeah.
so heavily next summer. But I'm sorry, James Gunn, just Power Girl as played by Sydney Sweeney, licensed to print money. That's my free
Oh, dear
idea for you there.
Lord, you're right. Oh, my God. Even this, like, dough face looks like Sydney Sweeney here. Oh,
Exactly.
my
That's right.
gosh.
I'm not just making a crude joke. The f her fa She has this face a little bit
Yeah.
of the way Joe Staten is drawing her here,
Yep.
aside from the other attributes. So
Right. No, you are dead on. I had not thought of that. Oh, my
there you
God.
go.
Wow.
There
Yeah.
you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Up next, a little more 30th century. Boop, 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 boop. You can tell it's more futuristic there. We're covering Quizlet from Who's Who, issue number 19, art by Greg LaRocque and Art Nichols. So Quizlet is just like a flying football, sort of kind of. It's like this silver football shaped thing with a little wing on the back is kind of what it is. And it's got like, I don't know, a little visor that looks like like a Knight of Camelot kind of visor, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, he's a little flying robot thing. It's not very big. And so you've got that in the foreground. And I sound like I'm mocking it. It's really nicely drawn. I mean, Greg LaRocque has drawn this really cool technologically floating thing, but he looks like Skeets kind of at the end of the day, really. It's kind of what you're looking at there. And then in the surprint, you've got sort of that, I guess you could call it that class of people or whatever the class that graduated to the Legion at that time in 1985. So you've got like Tellus and Magnetic Kid and Polar Boy and Princess Projecta and Quizlet. That's the group that joined the Legion at that point. Because at this point, Quizlet had only appeared a year before this. So he had first appeared in 1985. So here he's appearing in this issue in 1986, which, by the way, is proof that they could not have had this whole thing planned out when Who's Who started, because this character didn't even exist when Who's Who number one came out. So they did not know they needed to save a page for Quizlet, which means they could have put Sugar and Spike here, by God. Anyway, sorry. And then the logo looks great. It looks all sort of like chrome. With a little red background on it. What do you think of the art piece here?
It's beautifully drawn. It's beautifully drawn by Greg LaRocque and Art Nichols. I don't know who did the stipple effect on the inking. I'm going to assume it's Art Nichols. I think it's beautiful. But I'm sorry, Shag. This is the kind of thing that when I saw that this thing is a member of the Legion, I went, "Oh yeah, the Legion's awesome." It's just like, come on, what the f What is the wait? It's the football attached to the back of the USS Enterprise. Like, what? He's a member of the team. Like, come on. So, yeah, no, I'm sorry. This is a big no sale, but it's beautifully drawn. Beautifully drawn.
You're being very specious. You know, not everyone has to have two arms and two legs.
I know.
You know, aliens come in all shapes and sizes.
I know.
So he is an explorer from another dimension. He's a living sort of energy creature living inside this tiny flying capsule. And his powers are he can emerge from this little tiny vessel in like his energy form. He can possess inanimate objects. And then when he does, those objects disintegrate. Now, when you read this entry, and I assume you didn't, but and I'm sure I mentioned this last time, whatever, whenever we covered this 15 years ago, whatever. It is purposely written to be like so sus, like so suspicious. It says like
claims to be.
Right, exactly. Quizlet claims to be. And then although background I can't even say this. Although background checks on Quizlet were obviously impossible, it was accepted for Legion membership without a great deal of suspicion. They put the word suspicion in there on purpose. Like they're trying to make you think this dude is like going to betray the Legion, but like I looked ahead, like he doesn't. He's not a bad guy. I mean, he is lying a little bit. He's not this great explorer. He's actually like they have this hive mind back home, and yet he's like a little deviant. He likes to just have fun, so he stole that little spaceship and came to our dimension. But he's not a bad guy or anything. So you can find more of him on Legion of Super Bloggers. I couldn't think of really anywhere. I mean, there are podcasts out there that touch on the Legion. They just don't happen to travel in our circles of friends. But I don't really know where else where you'd find much on Quizlet.
Do we ever get to see what it looks like?
Well, he comes out and he's a little energy creature. So I guess, yeah, I would assume so, yeah.
Isn't that like the same shtick as Wildfire? Wasn't he energy contained in a suit?
Yeah, kind of,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, so we need two of those. Okay, all right, got it.
Oh, Lord. Dr. Ange, help me out here. All right. Boo, 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 boo. Oh, wait. Oh, I gotta sound like I'm underwater. Boo, 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 boo.
Scavenger. One of the lesser Aquaman villains, although that's tough to... it is. He's one of the lesser-known Aquaman villains. I'm not saying that as a qualitative. I'm just saying he's lesser-known. Yeah, that's what I meant. He didn't make it in any of the movies and stuff like that. Although, not that Aquaman has a lot of villains to kind of really, you know...
Although, didn't some of the guys in the Black Manta movie have, like, that kind of mask with, like, the teeth around the window?
Those movies slid right out of my brain the minute I left the theater. Literally, by the time I got into my car, I was like, did I see that? I don't know what happened. Yeah. But anyway, drawn by Ron Frenz and Bob Smith, and they are doing I don't think this is on purpose because this artist has no connection to this character or Aquaman, but they are doing the greatest George Tuska imitation Ooh. I've ever seen.
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
For the longest time, I thought this was drawn by George Tuska.
I give you that.
Exactly like his work, but yet it is not him at all. And I love it. I love how kind of old school it is, looking it is. It's really quite beautiful. I love the colors they use. I love the font. I like the slightly like scalloped edges. Mm-hmm. Like he's like it's a fishing hook kind of thing. He first appeared in Aquaman number 37. They've since rebooted him and given him like kind of a more like dynamic costume. But I kind of like this sort of just old timey sub guy. I love the mask that he looks through, and we see him pointing his gun at Aquaman, and then we see Aquaman and Aqualad in the background, and he's got his scavenger ship. I don't know. I you know he's again not. There's only so many variations of this you can do. Right, because it's like Black Manta and Ocean Master and the Fisherman and now Scavenger. It's kind of like, oh, they plunder the sea. Okay, I got it. But I like that he's kind of like a bruiser. I like his pose. He's kind of like hunched over and he's like, ah! I like stuff like that. So not a whole ton here, but visually it's really striking.
Yeah, it's a real treat. The color combination is absolutely stunning, right? It's basically just the whole thing's three colors. You got black lines. You got this dark blue for the foreground and the logo, but then everything else is like a purple surprint, and they really fill the space nicely with the surprint. Like they've got a nice shot of his close-up of his face inside mm-hmm. the mask just next to the logo. Then you've got him threading Aquaman. Then you got a little Aquaman and Aqualad. Then you got his ship on the bottom. It's really well balanced. I love this piece. When I first looked at it and I saw it with Ron Frenz, I was like, wow, is this one of his earliest drawings? Like, no, not at all. This comes after his Star Wars work. I felt stupid for thinking that. In fact, by the way, this comes out the same. This issue was Who's Who number 20. Came out the same month as Kickers Inc. number 1. So there we go.
Wow. What a thing to celebrate.
My beloved Kickers Inc., which he also drew. So that's why I mentioned that.
Yes.
But this could be Ron Frenz's first DC work, actually. Could quite be. And one of the things I love about the Scavenger is his first appearance is in Aquaman number 37. And the cover is this great Nick Carty cover, and it's like, "When the sea dies." And they don't mention this anywhere in the listing, which really disappoints me. But his gimmick in that issue was he was attacking them because he wanted a weapon. And the way he was attacking them is by making the sea rot. Like, I don't know how you rot water, but apparently the water rots and creates air pockets. Like, so when you're reading the comic, there would just be like holes where there wasn't water. It's very hard for me to explain. It's a very bizarre concept, but I love the idea of rotting the ocean. And it just stuck in my head. Cause I read that, you know, early on in my Aquaman collecting. So, and at this point, by the way, he'd only had four appearances, which is kind of shocking.
Well, right. That's what I was saying. He just was never that big of a villain. His ship is called the Scorpion ship. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They don't need to call it ship. Just call it the Scorpion. That's,
no, good,
that's good enough. And all, by the way, the height and weight, completely ridiculous. 5'9", 175. Look at this guy. This guy looks, this guy's 240. He looks like a linebacker. Like, what are they talking about? There's no way this guy's 176 pounds. But yeah, for a kind of not much character, this is a really successful listing. And I would love to, I mean, I go on and on about Bob Smith as an inker. Like, I just, he inks everybody really well. I would have loved to see these two do something else together. This is a really snappy piece.
It's fun. Now, I hate to ask this on the air and call you out. I don't really know. Can people still get to the Aquaman Shrine, or is it gone now?
It's unfortunately gone.
Okay.
It's been taken over by bots.
Oh, lovely. Okay. I was just trying to think of some place to send people for more information.
Sorry.
There isn't really.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. All right. Gone to the mist of time.
Well, it's an amazing piece, and I absolutely love it. And again, the colors work. It just, the whole thing works so really well.
Great stuff.
All right.
Beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, boop. Last of the classic entries, we have The Weather Wizard, drawn by Carmen Infantino, Murphy Anderson. Hands on hips. And you do the jump to the left. No, it's of course one of Flash's great films. His first appearance is Flash 110, so he comes before Captain Boomerang.
Yep.
Weather Wizard, you know, of course, it moved on to live action. Actually, a version of him even appears in the classic 1997 JL pilot.
Yep, exactly right.
Played by Miguel Ferrer. Mark Marden is his secret identity because they're doing the alliteration thing. We got him standing there. Then we see him getting pasted by Batman. We see him going after Flash in a couple different ways. And then there's this sort of, it's like a backward Z
or a seven, like
or
what the hell is
seven.
That about?
I don't exactly know what that is supposed to represent in any way.
Wasn't just me. Okay.
Okay. And we see him without his mask. I love that his official group affiliation is Flash's Rogues Gallery. Like, that's an actual group
Capital
that gets
letters.
Together, you know? but I mean, basically, yeah, he's got this little wand that he can control the weather with. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. And we see him implementing that over the Flash here. His wand projects eolic energy or eolic, excuse me, eolic, not eotic. It sounds like erotic. With energy,
whoa,
which he can create any atmospheric or weather effect over a small area for a limited period of time. So if you need him to water your lawn, just get him and he can just do that for you to take care of it.
So I got to talk about these powers for a second, because if it keeps going, he can create solid rainbows. He can instantly weather things as if they've been weathered and make walls crumble, and it can travel by riding clouds. What the hell, Silver Age? I mean, those are bridges too far for me. I can get on board with a guy with a wand who can make it rain, but solid rainbows, that's just too far.
Glad to have limits.
You know, seeing this entry with Carmen Infantino inked by Murphy Anderson, and a little while ago we saw the Carmen Infantino inked by Bob Smith. I didn't understand when you kept saying how much you liked Bob Smith inking Carmen Infantino. I'm like, I don't get it. What's different? Now I see it. Mm-hmm. The line here is a lot gentler. It's a lot softer. It's a lot more Silver Age-y. Whereas Bob Smith did bring a different, completely different kind of energy. Yeah. Like here, Weather Wizard's face is just like so doofy. Like that smile, like, oh, hey guys.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, good to see you. At the time this came out, he was supposedly reformed. He actually teamed up with Blue Devil to take down the other rogues in an issue of Blue Devil, which is always super fun. But at his core, he's a pretty bad dude. Like he's a criminal. He goes to see his brother. He finds his brother's dead body And he's got this machine that makes, you know, controls the weather, and it's like, deuces, I'm out. And he takes it, and he's, you know, he steals his brother's invention and becomes a villain with it. So, and his brother was, you know, obviously going to help the world. And the costume, explain the costume to me.
Yeah, it's yeah, he's got this sash going on, which kind of looks like the police tape they put up,
Yes,
you
it
know.
does.
It's yeah, he's got the big scoop neck thing. He's got he's got an open chest kind of down to like his mid pecs. It's jolly. It's a jolly look.
Loose fitting pirate shirt, the big wing collar,
Yeah.
as it was either you or Brett Young said, yeah, you know, peripheral vision's, you know, overrated.
Yeah, right.
So
Easy to sneak up on the Weather Wizard, which you can see
exactly.
Batman doing in the
Yep.
surprint as he comes up and just smacks Weather Wizard across the face.
So this is Who's Who number 25, almost the end of the series at that point. So yeah, you can see him in the 1990s failed Justice League pilot. He's on the Flash TV show. I mean, I think he was in the pilot of the Flash TV show too. Like, he's the pilot guy, I think, is kind of how this works. So that is all I've got to say about that, Rob.
Okay.
All right. So those are your 13 entries. And remember, leave your comments on our website. We want to hear about it. Now we are going to transition to Zoom's Who. Zoom and Isamu Yukinori's addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. So, Rob, why don't you tell us about this entry?
Oh man, this is so good. Supermobile. It feels weird to just say Supermobile, not the Supermobile. But Supermobile, which is the little spaceship that Superman needed sometimes. They came up with these little robotic arms that came out and grabbed things.
Do they make that noise?
They do. In
Okay.
deep space, no one can hear you scream. But no, nevertheless. Drawn by Kurt Swan and Zoom Yukinori. Fantastic team there. This features a wonderful schematic we see in color. We see Superman piloting the ship. And then we see front view, side view, and then the control panels, and as well as all the details of it. It does not list the first appearance of the Supermobile, which I looked up. You're welcome, everybody. Action Comics number 481, which features an amazing cover by JLGLPBHN of Superman using the Supermobile to smack Amazo in the face, which is really great.
Did you
Now,
call him
I meant to
Amazo?
say Amazo. I meant to
Okay.
say Amazo. I got carried away with it.
Real quick, I want to just add that is not listing the first appearance is actually not a mistake. That is consistent with what Who's Who would
Well,
do.
I did not say it was a mistake. I
Well,
just
I
said
know
they didn't
that.
do it.
Before someone to write in, though, I just wanted to let
Okay,
you know,
right. No, it's not a mistake. Right.
Yukinoris are on top of this,
Yeah,
folks. I mean,
no,
it's
they
it,
do not make mistakes when it comes to this stuff. No. They are keeping in the tradition
Yep.
of the listings. I'm just saying for anyone, in case you're
Yeah.
wondering, when did that come out? It came out in the late 70s. Of course, it was a
1978.
late 70s edition when Superman was kind of at his, well, no, Superman in the 50s was his goofiest, I'd say so, but late 70s. But anyway, this should have gotten a listing. Absolutely. Because to me, anything that appears in the comic book that then became a toy multiple times deserves a listing. I mean, to me, it has achieved pop culture, ubiquity. Like, is it the Batmobile? No, but there was a Corgi toy, and there was, of course, a Superpowers toy. So if once it achieved that level of fame, it should have gotten its own listing. Now, I understand why it didn't, because by this point, they were focusing on the John Byrne era of Superman, and Supermobile was no more at that point. So I get why they didn't do it, but I think it deserved it because this was like a sweet ride that Superman had. Those robot arms are just the fun, the best. That is just such a great detail that these arms come out and just grab you and do stuff.
I only remember this thing from the Superpowers line.
Right.
I mean, I know it appeared in the comics. I'm not denying its existence. I just wasn't reading that era of Superman. And reading the entry, one of the things that just blew my mind is this ship, I don't know if you read it or not, but has no engine. There is no propulsion unit in this vehicle. It is instead moved by Superman's flight power from a seated position. So he's if you were to envision him sitting in the cockpit and then just mentally take the ship away, he's flying in a seated position, and that is what's giving the ship its propulsion, which is so interesting. The only time I can remember ever seeing it like that is there was a Hawkman issue where Superman flew Hawkman's ship from the inside by flying. He like flew against the floor and like moved the ship. But I what a crazy concept.
There's no reason to do that. There's no good on, there's no earthly or Kryptonian reason to make that the thing. Like, just make it the ship. Like, what's wrong with that? I don't understand. I love that Superman has learned from Batman in terms of branding, right? He sticks his S shield on the nose and the S shield on the the back, not the fin, the
tail,
whatever.
Tail fin.
Yeah, the tail fin. I guess it is the tail fin. So I like that Superman has learned, like, hey, you got to brand stuff if you want to make it somewhere. So I dig this, and I'm going to call my shot now. This thing is going to show up in the next Superman movie. I don't know that for a fact, but I just think that feels like something James Gunn would do, right?
How,
it's gonna hang in the background or something.
How early did you start drinking today? Oh my god!
What does that seem like an unreasonable guess to make?
Yes, it does.
Oh, I don't think so. The Superman robots are in the first movie, for Pete's sakes. I think we're going to see the Supermobile hanging in the background in like one shot. Not he's not going to use it. But I think there's going to be a scene of him in the fortress, and we're going to just see it in the background. That's my – I'm calling that.
I don't know if we're going to get another Superman movie. I think that the next movie with Superman will be a team-up of some sort.
He's already writing it, supposedly.
Oh, really?
Doesn't mean they're going to make it, but I mean supposedly they're writing it.
I thought I had heard that they were going to do a team-up sort of thing. Okay. By the way, the ship is also made of the hardest metal in the known universe called Supermananium. See, this is why I make fun. Like earlier when I said that I couldn't believe Grant Morrison's Animal Man is just a few steps away from pre-crisis. Like this is what pre-crisis is to me. Like I adore this and I love that it exists in a Who's Who entry, but it's just stupid. Like this is like, I love it, but I can also see at the same time, this is just embarrassing. Like I would not want someone to see this if I was trying to explain it in the comics was a serious art form. You know, it's like, so.
I don't know what to tell you. I love this thing so completely.
All right.
I love it so much.
Well, thank you.
Great job by great job, of course, by Kurt Swan and Zoom and Isabu Yukinori.
Absolutely.
As usual.
Great job, y'all. Great job to our Zoom, who we miss dearly, and our nephew Isamu. Absolutely. Yep. All right, folks, again, all these will appear on our website. So you can go out to fireandwaterpodcast.com, look for the Who's Who entry for Who's Who review number 10. You can see all the entries there. And then leave your feedback. I want to hear your thoughts. I need to see Matt Ev leave me like a 15-page thesis on Animal Man is what I need. So give me that stat. I don't even know if he listens to this show. I don't know. But anyway, I want to hear your thoughts because we will read them on the next episode, which right now we are going to take a podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to read your thoughts from the previous episode.
Hey, you didn't ask me what my favorites were.
Oh my gosh, Rob, what are your favorites? Yeah, you're right. Like,
what the hell, man?
I am totally out of practice. So what are your favorite entries from this quote-unquote issue? Again, the Zoom's Who's off the table.
Right,
so.
right, of course. A lot of good ones here, but I'd have to, like the Doom Elastic Girl one is great, but if I had, just limit down to three. Animal Man, Global Guardians, just because the poses are so dynamic, and Scavenger.
Oh, okay. Good choices. As much as I love the Animal Man character, I'm not voting for that one. I enjoy it, but it's not. But I mean, but when it's in a book with Elastigirl by John Byrne or Dr. Light by Ron Randall, that's a hell of a piece. That I absolutely love that one. Which one was the other one? I'm torn between Scavenger and Power Girl. I think I'm going to have to give it to Scavenger just because the design is so great.
Yeah, Scavenger. Great piece.
So yeah. But a lot of great choices. Hard to narrow it down to three. Lots of good ones here. So, all right. Awesome. Okay. Now we're going to play some podcast promos. And when we come back, we're going to cover your feedback from the last episode.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
Batman.
A long time ago, in a comic book rack far, far away. During the years between The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, Marvel Comics kept the Star Wars magic alive, delivering bold new stories, expanding the mythology, and taking our favorite heroes and villains on unforgettable adventures. Now join me, the irredeemable Shag, and an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we journey back to this incredible era. We begin with a comic adaptation of The Empire Strikes Back and continue through the thrilling tales leading up to Return of the Jedi. If you're a seasoned Star Wars veteran who knows your Shira Bree from your hoojibs, or a brave explorer venturing into these comics for the first time, this is your hyperspace lane to classic Star Wars adventure. Join us for Marvel Star Wars, From Empire to Jedi, every other month on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And I don't know about you folks at home, but during that commercial break, I spent my time just staring lovingly at the display case next to my desk, which features a lot of action figures, and I was staring specifically at my Animal Man action figure. So that's how I spent the break. All right, now we're going to cover your who's who, hows, and whys. These are your comments on our website. Remember, go out to firewaterpodcast.com, leave your comments there. By the way, we ask this each time. I'm going to ask again. If you don't mind, please leave us some iTunes reviews. More would always help. It helps raise the profile of the show. You can just look for Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DNC Universe, and leave your review there. Now, I do have a favor to ask. If you leave a review and you're outside the United States, let us know, because we got
howdy, is that complicated.
We got notified about a review from out of the United States, and we can't find it. So please let us know. Anyway, again, it's don't just type in who's who. You'll never find us. You type in like who's who definitive, and you'll find us. All right. So first up, Uncle Bruno's Customs left some great posts. He posted some images after listening to the last episode. He had a lot of fun with the characters we covered. I don't know if you saw this. He posted one image of every single character we covered. I mean, it's got Tarantula and the Manhunters and Gypsy and his custom Captain Fear and Superman and Night Slayer and Dr. Light, Hugo Strange and Brainwave. But more importantly, he included a custom homemade version of Balloon Buster. And the quote he put, he says, from the 1998 Owen Wilson classic film, I Am the Gun. And Uncle Bruno, you made my day with that image. And it is so incredible. I think it's a Paul Newman action figure is what it really looks like. But it is exactly what I needed to see. I love this thing.
It looks like Owen Wilson. It really does.
It does.
I mean, I got to say, he did it amazing. Yeah, wow. He really did an amazing job.
It could be an Armageddon action figure for all I know. I don't know. But the neckerchief is what sells it in the goggles. So it looks great. Thank you, Uncle Bruno. Then we heard from Hal. And by the way, I should mention, we take all the feedback that you post on our website. That's what we're reading is the website, the feedback there. And we collect all that. And there's so much content, we can't read it all. So we're just cherry picking bits and pieces. So if you don't hear your entire comment, don't be offended. It's just there's no way we can read all of it. So we're going to start off with Hal. Some of the things he says is, this show was particularly memorable for me since it included the character who pulled me into the greater DC universe. I had seen DC comics before, Superman, probably some Batman, but it wasn't until an older kid gave me his copy of Justice League of America number 12 that I was hooked. Suddenly, there was a whole universe of colorful and exciting characters, all courtesy of Dr. Light and Snapper Carr. Wow. And then I had asked about Dr. Light and his origin, because there was this whole thing about Hawkman before he met the Justice League, and I was confused about that. And he says, to answer Shag's question, originally the JLA did not know about Dr. Light. As he explained to Snapper Carr, if he was going to become a master criminal, he would eventually have a run-in with one of them or more of the costume heroes. So he figured his best bet was a preemptive strike before they knew of his existence. His confrontation with Hawkman was a later retcon from an issue of the comic Wanted, after they stopped reprints and moving into new stories. It was later retconned again, as an unnamed Thanagarian wingman, that'd be after Hawkman and continuity confusion. It was not Hawkman. And then later was erased from continuity entirely.
All right. He continues on. He says, I have been corresponding with Isamu and doing an entry on the pre-Nelson Strong Adventurers Club. They actually go all the way back to 1940, but never had a dedicated series before Adventure Comics 426. That entry may or may not be in issue 4 of Zoom Zoo. Isamu planned on giving you some information on the Adventurers Club. I hope I didn't steal his thunder. One interesting fact I came across in my research that Rob might find interesting. The story that appeared in Weird War Tales number 28, The Isle of Lost Men, or Soldiers, can't remember the exact title right now, was originally written as a story for the Adventurers Club and scheduled for Adventure Comics number 430. It was not in that issue, and when the series got canceled, Joe Orlando adapted it for Weird War. I had no idea.
That is wild. Wild.
Yeah, that's really cool. That is fascinating stuff. I want to go dig that issue up because that sounds really cool. I mean, I would love to know if it's drawn by Jim Aparo because he did the other. That'd be really cool. But yeah, that's fascinating stuff. Thank you, Hal. And then Isamu, we just mentioned, clocked Ben, and he says, a fun show yet again, Uncle Rob and Uncle Shag. Some somewhat brief notes this time around. Brainwave, the live-action Brainwave and the Superman 50th Anniversary Special was paid by Robert Smigel, who did those TV Funhouse cartoon spoofs for Saturday Night Live. I don't know how I got that wrong.
Wow.
As soon as I heard myself on the show, I'm like, why did I say that? That's not Bob Odenkirk. It's Robert Smigel, who, of course, has triumphed the insult comic dog, among other things. So I pulled a boner on that one, as they say. I don't know how I got that wrong. He continues on. Dr. Light is a unique JLA villain for essentially invading, having his own version of Zatanna's quest, appearing in multiple comic titles throughout the Silver Age and Bronze Age, as he fought individual Justice Leaguers. I do remember that. That was, and they even collected that into a trade paperback at some point.
Huh.
The new Dr. Light was originally supposed to be a black woman, according to the DC Sampler number 2. Man, I remember when we covered that 11 years ago on that 9-hour show with Frank, which has a cameo illustration of her in the New Teen Titans preview drawn by George Perez. According to an interview with Mr. Perez in Comics Interview number 50, that plan changed because of the Captain Marvel character over at Marvel, who was originally written originally a white male superhero and now became a black female superheroine, and whose power also had something to do with light and energy. So when they created the new Dr. Light in Crisis, Mr. Perez suggested she be Japanese instead. I did not know that. He mentions Dad had, meaning Zoom, of course, had always actually done a dramatic recording of that non-existent Millennium podcast, by the way, which is going to be hosted by a real nice man who makes these podcasts about that obscure experimental super character Uncle Shag talked about. I have to find Dad's notes on the Young All-Stars crossover issues he was going to cover. All I remember is that those segments were going to include a music clip of Samantha Fox's I Promise You, I'll Take You Away, and Dad would share some stories from his father and Uncle Kenzo about living in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. I don't think Zoom no longer being with us stops him from producing new podcast episodes. It hasn't to this point. So
true. But the Millennium podcast isn't happening. It wasn't his Millennium podcast.
No,
it was somebody
right.
else's. So yeah.
Right.
But I am also not shocked to hear that it was going to have a Samantha Fox sound clip in there.
No, that's completely right in the Zoom playbook.
Yep. Then we'll hear from Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star, The Space Princess, and other stories. He says, now, Gypsy was in the last issue, and we talked a lot about Justice League Detroit. He says, the problem with the Detroit League is all these characters are better by themselves than together. Also, it's the older hero teaches rookies, to which Rob says, why would I want that when Batman and the Outsiders does that with Jim Aparo art? Which apparently, though, for Rob, though, it didn't Rob McCarthy, it didn't stop him from pitching a Steel and Vixen story to DC Comics. All right.
Good to know. Edo Boznar says, oh, man, Rob, how could you forget the Captain Fear episode of Who's That? It's one of my favorites after the Starfire episode. Guys, Edo, we've done 1,000 podcasts. I can't remember them all.
No, I'm in this camp as well. How, like, we spent so much time talking about Captain Fear. We did so much research on it. Like, I can understand why you might not remember what we said, but the fact that it doesn't even exist, that's crazy.
Dude, we did that episode of Fire and Water where we covered that Brave and the Bold with Aquaman and Demon, having no memory that I did it with Ryan a bunch of years earlier.
Oh, no. It's true.
I'm also a bit surprised that neither of you noted that Kevin O'Neill is also quite well known as the artist for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Okay, I do want to stop there. That... I listened to Who's Who over again. It's the only show of mine that I listen to once it comes out. It wasn't like I misspoke, but I think I was unclear. When I was mentioning Kevin O'Neill, I was mentioning what I thought he was famous for at the time, which to me was the context of how did he get this gig? Because Kevin O'Neill was not a typical DC artist. How did he get a Who's Who gig? And I was thinking, what was he most famous for at the time? Which was, I thought, Epic's Martial Law. He, of course, went on to leave Extraordinary Gentlemen, but that was long after Who's Who. So that was, that's what I meant. I may would not have been very clear, but that's sort of what I was saying. I was like, what was the context of Kevin O'Neill getting this gig in Who's Who in 1985 or whatever? That's what I meant. But
if it makes you feel any better, I'm the same way. When I think of Kevin O'Neill, I think of Martial Law. When I think of Living Extraordinary Gentleman, I think of Alan Moore, mm-hmm. not Kevin O'Neill. So right. I'm right there with you. Martial Law is the first thing I think of when I think of him.
Yeah, I mean, the League is undoubtedly the most famous thing he's been a part of. They turned it into a terrible movie and stuff like that. But that's whenever I think about, oh, hey, this artist landed in Who's Who. That's strange. What were they doing at the time? And mm-hmm. that's what I think about, because that's what the editors were thinking about. And so that might have been like, oh, they saw him. I mean, I'm sure they saw his work on the British weeklies and things like that. But he was in America doing the epic stuff. That's what I was thinking. So sorry, Adam. Anyway, he continues. I quit being mean to Don Heck. I think the art for the Mars injury looks perfectly fine. That aside, I quite enjoyed the show as usual. Personally, I really liked the art in the Malagigi, Night Slayer, and Hugo Strange entries, and agree that the Superman art with Byrne inking Swan is very nice. Byrne, in fact, is a pretty good inker when he wants to be. One of the most interesting inking jobs he did was on Steve Ditko's pencils in Avengers Annual number 13. Never even
Whoa.
Seen that. Yeah, never
wow.
seen that. And finally, when Rob exclaimed, who the hell? It made me think that would be a great name for another Who's Who spinoff show. Either that or rename the aforementioned Who's That? who the hell? Joe X says, Evan Dorkin, Kyle Baker, Robbie Bush, and Stephen DeStefano released the Instant Piano anthology together through Dark Horse and won an Eisner for it. So suck it, Greenberger. A little mean, but okay. Jeff R. says, Hugo Strange spent decades being the missing piece of the Bat Universe after he was reintroduced to the post-crisis audience with the Prey storyline in Legends of the Dark Knight. We've been left waiting for a definitive modern Hugo Strange story in the comics. Arkham City eventually gave one in another media. And there was a long stretch of Batman events / line crossovers with mystery villains who could have been fairly revealed as Hugo Strange, but he still hasn't really gotten his due. Instead, his strongest stories are still retelling of the old ones, the aforementioned Prey, and the also Matt Wagner's Batman and the Monster Men mini. Also, I'm with Rob. Superman's story is an immigrant story. Making him technically American-born loses that and gains nothing but the possibility of his being president, which is a dead-end idea anyhow. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the support.
Everybody supported you in that. I like the idea of Superman's birthing chamber opening on Earth and him being born on Earth. I'm apparently the only one on Earth that likes that.
So. You and J.J. Abrams. You're the only two that liked it.
All right. Then we heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl Hunters podcast. Tim says, as part of my podcast rereading for Batman and the Outsiders comics from the 80s, I also reread Batman and Detective Comics from those same months. And boy, so many of those issues feature Nocturna and the Night Thief / Night Slayer. They were definitely Doug Mensch's pet characters. The entries are both characters don't do justice to just how icky the relationship got, especially Nocturna's fascination with both Batman and Jason Todd. Ew. So what's my point? Oh, well, that the last appearance I noted for Night Slayer was a couple of panels in Batman number 400, that oversized anniversary issue where they got just about every Bat villain together and Mensch grand finale from the era. Like lots of other villains, Nighty just wandered off muttering about Nocturna rather than getting pulled into another fight with Batman and Ra's al Ghul. That was basically it for the Man in Black in the era of Batman as far as I read. And then he says, I'll say it, I love Gypsy's entry. Chuck Patton knocked it out of the park. Well, I'm right there with you, Tim. I think you and I are the only ones coming to Gypsy's defense.
I was supportive of the artwork. I still don't like the character very much, but the artwork. By the way, can I just throw a little personal thing? We're recording this just a couple days after my birthday. And it's just something that the 11-year-old me, the 12-year-old me never would have thought. I got birthday thanks from both Alan Brennert and Chuck Patton, right? And that is not something that when I was 11 or 12 reading these comics and like worshiping these people, that I would have been like, they're not even real people. They like live up on Olympus somewhere, right? Because they draw comic book, you know, they write and draw comic books. And the idea that like I was looking at my phone and like Chuck Patton is like, hey, Roth, happy birthday. I'm like, wow, that's wow, you know?
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Pretty cool. So, by the way, it was just Chuck's birthday just a couple days later. So we're both Leos, apparently.
Nice.
Movie Matt Royce from the TV Movie Rewind podcast, which I was a guest on once, says, I was so excited when you guys promoted this episode's release. I actually woke up early on Sunday to listen. Yes, I need to get a life. Wow, man. Holy Christ.
I love that though, Matt. Thank you, that's fantastic.
Jeez, that's like getting up on early Saturday morning to watch cartoons. The randomizer, which I'm beginning to suspect doesn't actually make a booping noise, but
nothing gets past Matt.
Brought us two former Who's That stars, Balloon Buster and Captain Fear. I really miss that show. The Roving Ranger did indeed show up in All-Star Squadron 54-55. He even made the cover of 55. He was part of a group of time-displaced heroes that included Silent Knight, Liberty Bell, Viking Prince, and others. They team up with Firebrand, a Shag's favorite, to stop the Ultra Humanite from stealing a NASA space shuttle. This was a great episode. It's a lot of fun to listen to the two of you discuss the lower-tier DC characters. Superman was in that issue. He's talking about lower tier, but okay.
Hey, real quick, I have been promising for years, and I'm still standing by. I will do this. I am going to do an episode of Who's That on the Red Bee with a particular listener who loves the Red Bee. He and I both bought the collections of the original Golden Age stories and everything. So, and I'll probably release it both on the Who's That feed and on JSA in the 90s or something. But the Red Bee will get a Who's That at some point, maybe 100 years from now, but it's going to happen.
Okay. I know it'll get flagged for copyright and all that crap, but you need to end the audio with the John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd singing King Bee on Saturday Night Live from the second season, because it's badass and that fits. Anyway, Chris Franklin, of course, from our very network, does all a bunch of shows, wrapping up JLU cast soon and is part of the re-exhumed Batman Nightcast, says, fun show as always, gents, and you are both pretty. We enjoyed our time with both of you and Kelly. Rob did bring me a really cool t-shirt and Cindy a tote bag she now uses every day, though. Just saying.
You know what, Chris? I'm above bribes. You know, my present to you is my presence. Okay. That should have been enough. And the fact that you've gone all materialism, I think it just speaks volumes. Okay. Oof,
boy, that's a Yankee swap if I ever heard one. Regarding some characters, Mal Gigi, what a nice entry. Colin's humor work, he co-created Richie Rich, Rob's favorite, shines through here.
I had no idea.
I remember that time when Mal Gigi had like 17 titles to himself with a decent line. It was kind of amazing.
Yeah, he crossed over with Hot Stuff, I think. then Chris says about the Manhunters, in one of the early issues of the Jeff Johns, Carlos Pacheco post-Green, there's a lot of phrases here. It was the Green Lantern series. It was after Rebirth. Anyway, Hal is falling through the air with a completely discharged power ring, and he's battling a Manhunter robot. Hal flips up the faceplate of the Manhunter and charges his ring from the internal Owen battery inside the robot, turns into Green Lantern, and flies off. It's one of those great cinematic fist-pumping moments heroes that stand out in my mind and gets me excited about superhero comics. When I think of the Manhunters, I see this scene. Chris, I completely forgot about that. That is a fantastic moment with Hal. You're absolutely right. It was wonderful. So I'm glad you brought that up. That's because the Manhunters don't always get enough credit, and that was a great moment.
That does sound really cool, I have to say. I've never read that sounds really neat.
And then Night Slayer, it says Tim Price nailed it. Mensch loved Night Slayer and Nocturna, and I got to where I loathed them. They just wouldn't go away. Now, Jerry Conway balanced the soap opera well with the action in his prior Batman run. Mensch just got too sudsy for my tastes.
Regarding Professor Hugo Strange, Mensch did a much better job on the aforementioned Prey storyline in Legends, featuring a much kinkier version of old Hugo here. I think Dennis Cowan got the art gig because he just drew Batman Annual number 10 featuring Strange, also written by Mensch. Makes total sense. The close-up of Strange, it looks like the ghostly image Rogers drew in the classic Tech Run, and Rob's right. The hitchhiking ghost, another Disney World reference, a bit where he strangles Rupert Thorne is chilling. Yes, thank you so much for the support there, Chris.
Chris, also, without going to the specifics, I mentioned the Adventurers Club from Disney and Pleasure Island last time. Chris is the only one in the comments who has heard of it as well, so that gave me a little relief. Ryan Daly chimed in specifically about Chris's comments from the Firewater Podcast Network, of course, Cheerscast and Batman Nightcast. After hearing Chris's comments on Night Slayer, Ryan says, making a note to strike the Night Slayer Nocturna run from the list of upcoming episodes of Nightcast.
They can get to the Max Allen Collins stuff that much faster. That's great.
No.
Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Books Commentary, and the Legion of Super Bloggers, where they probably talk about Quizlet a lot, says, amazing episode as always. Just a couple of comments. Captain Fear has no right to look this good. I say that about myself. Simonson can do no wrong, even if the guy is wearing his dad's suit. And then here we go. Manhunters, settle in. A. I'm picturing Ange in like a medical, like some sort of like, you know, he's teaching medical students, settle in, everybody. You're okay.
It's like a long PowerPoint. He's got one of those pointer sticks.
Totally. Yeah. Anyway, he says, A, I always thought that the Manhunters represented martial law, soldiers bringing order to worlds regardless of methods. As such, why not have martial law artist O'Neill draw them? Makes sense. B, I reviewed those JLA Manhunter issues on my site a while back. I had always thought that the Manhunters were the original police force for the Owens was old history. Finding out that Engelhardt just created that whole cloth in the 70s floored me. So first issue special is the first appearance of Mark Shaw and the cult, but the robot Manhunters first appeared in JLA 140. C, I was waiting, for Event Leviathan to be brought up here since Shaw ended up the mastermind. Waiting, all caps. And then Shad goes... And remember, the Manhunters were involved in a summer crossover, and I am driving and giddy, thinking, here it is, Event Leviathan. And then Shad completes the sentence, Millennium. What an absolute F.
So if you don't know, like, Dr. Ange went overboard on Event Leviathan. Like, he went nuts to the point where Brian Michael Bendis had to take out a, like, a restraining order against Dr. Ange. It got scary. And so... I did, in hindsight, I am mad at myself because I planned all along to crack a joke about Mark Shaw and Event Leviathan and basically say something like, and now Dr. Ange will write his dissertation. And I failed to, I did mention Event Leviathan in the feedback, but I failed to mention it in the bulk of the episode. So I apologize, Dr. Ange. So sorry.
I will say, I do want to give him credit. Ange recently sent me a package, which was a Dan Jurgens signed copy of the Superman Treasury Hero for All. And he even got Dan to inscribe it. Here's one for Treasury Cast, which was amazing.
Oh, wow.
And he sent some crypto dog biscuits for our dog Pippa. Very sweet gesture and very appreciated.
So sweet. So thoughtful. That guy, always so nice with this, what he calls secret missions, is what he calls those when he goes to meet creators. Then we hear from Bucky749, the American Samurai, has his own YouTube channel. He says, Brainwave looks like one of the keepers from the Star Trek pilot, The Cage. So he's my number one this time. He's not wrong. I mean,
no,
he really
not
does.
Wrong at all, yeah.
They were from Al Girding. See if you can decipher this. He says, I really enjoyed this episode. The Brainwave entry really brought back some good memories from the All-Star Squadron and some early Infinity Inc. issues. Please note that everything is in lowercase, except for certain letters. And if you look at the letters that are in uppercase, it spells, that's right, Red B. That is awesome, Al. I love that. And when I said earlier I'm going to do a Who's That episode on the Red B, I think you know who my guest is going to be now.
That is like right out of Seven, what that is. That is some serial killer shit. I'm sorry.
Don't open the beehive. Or what's in the beehive? What's in the beehive?
Oh, no. I take it back. No, you can't end the show with King B from SNL. You got to end with Nicolas Cage from the remake of The Wicker Man, where he goes, not the bees, because they put the bee mask on him. That's what you got to end it with.
I love that. That's a great
idea.
And
that won't get struck copyright-wise.
I'm doing none of that. But anyway, okay. Perfect.
Telling you how to do your shows.
I noticed.
Noah Tarnow from the Big Quiz Thing and the I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast, which is basically this show, says, meanwhile, he's talking about Balloon Buster. Meant to get that context. Meanwhile, his base of operations is France, circa World War I. Likewise, Malgigi's includes in the 8th century AD. It's kind of funny how Who's Who would deem a time period to be a base, but I guess that makes sense in a universe where it seems like anyone with a high-tech doohickey can time travel.
That's fair. That's a good point, yeah. Then he goes on to say about Gypsy. He goes, well, it's ridiculous that the JLA would have a minimally powered 15-year-old member. I find it even more ridiculous that the member runs around barefoot. You did make me think about what if there's broken glass? Yeah. Anyway, that said, I truly love Justice League Detroit. It was the first ongoing story arc that I really cared about, and a recent reread was sufficiently engaging. The four new members all had contrasting personas and real character growth, culminating in what I still consider a shocking finale. There we go. A nice endorsement for JLD.
He mentions Brainwave's group affiliation, fails to mention his stint with the Secret Society of Supervillains as part of that awesome Perez-drawn JLA story that made Rob crave a Rex Tyler Auerman solo series. Absolutely. And yes, Isamu in the Superman TV special, The Wave, was portrayed by Robert Smigel, we already covered that, who's responsible for a lot of great comedy of the past 30 or so years, most notably for me, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. Brainwave is a great would-be conqueror for me to poop on.
I wonder why you're reading all that. All for that punchline.
Yeah, just all for that joke. I will say one more thing about Robert Smigel. There is a documentary on Hulu, everybody, from many.
This is the longest feedback section ever. None of it is about the feedback.
A lot of good stuff here. I don't know. Who would I care about Scavenger? There is a there's a documentary on Hulu called Too Funny to Fail. And it is about the short-lived Dana Carvey show, which aired for like 6 months, not even 6 months, in like 1994. It was a giant flop on ABC. And he had this murderer's row of talent behind the scenes and on camera before they got famous. And Robert Smigel was the producer, and he had Stephen Colbert and Stephen Carell before they both got famous. And like on the writing staff was like Louis C.K. and like Spike Jones or Charlie Kaufman, maybe. Like, it was insane, the talent pool he had. But anyway, there is a moment in that documentary where the documentary filmmakers show, I don't want to give it away, but they show something that Colbert and Carell and Dana Carvey had never seen before related to the promotion of their show. And they record them giving an honest reaction live on camera. And it is the funniest thing I've ever seen in a documentary in my life. And it's on Hulu. And I constantly have that joke in the movie queued up. So every time I open it, it's right at the end of that thing. And I go back 2 minutes. I watch it. It makes me feel better. And then I leave it there and I go back to it a couple months later. It is the funniest friggin' thing you've ever seen. It starts with Robert Smigel talking about learning that their show was following Home Improvement. That's the beginning of the bit. And it is unbelievable. And one other thing about Robert Smigel.
Wait, before you get off that. So the documentary is called Too Funny to Fail. And what was the show about? What was the show that the documentary is talking about?
It's the Dana Carvey Show, which was a...
Oh, it's called The Dana Carvey Show.
Yeah, The Dana Carvey Show. It was a sketch show that he did after he left Saturday Night Live.
Gotcha.
And everyone thought he was going to be kind of like this family comedy comedian, and it was not. It was dark and weird and edgy, and it just burned out. And one other thing about Robert Smigel, he appeared at a con a bunch of years ago, and for whatever reason, Kelly and I did not stop by to see his table. We've never seen him again at another show. We always regret it because we would have loved to have talked to him. So hopefully he makes it down to Florida sometime. Okay, done with Robert Smigel.
David Smigel hour. Okay.
Yeah, seriously, Robert Smigel hour. Noah says one more thing. He says, I agree that the Superman entry suffers a bit from the tiny color image of the Man in Steel, but Rob, I don't think a third page would be necessary. Look at the Barry Allen Flash entry, which broke the text into separate pieces on different pages, allowing for a larger vertical image. Not sure why that approach wasn't repeated for the other two page A listers. Yes, absolutely. He continues on, I understand why Rima and all the other public domain characters never got listings in the original series. It's a slippery slope from the Jungle Lady and the Super Friends to freaking Santa Claus, who guest starred in DC Comics Presents after all.
I'm not alone then. There we go.
It's reasonable, right? Why you can't. We just talked about like the Dr. Miss thing. You don't want to get into like, we don't own these characters. Finally, yes, Who's Who was very inconsistent about whether the series aimed to represent DC's publishing history or its standard superhero continuity. The letter columns always seem to emphasize the whole history, but the bias towards super characters really undermine that. I'm going to reiterate a retroactive suggestion you guys read and praised on an episode years ago. The original series should have made room for half a dozen or so double-page entries, each spotlighting the various characters in one of DC's genres of yesteryear. Two pages featuring funny animals, two pages featuring teen humor characters, etc. It would have done a lot to truly represent the company's history and been a far better use of space than some villain featured in two Green Arrow backup stories 5 years earlier. Finally, I think you guys should consider having guests on future episodes of Who's Who Review. You'd be making a bunch of us nerds very, very happy. I'm just terrified of how long an episode would get at that point.
Yeah. That's where we've talked about it before. First of all, it would break the format of the show that we've been doing for 12 years. And yeah, it would become expansive, ridiculously expansive. So that's the struggle.
Yeah.
But all right. Up next is Mark Baker Wright from the Not Your Father's Autobot podcast. Mark says, so we were asked to tell you how much we love the boop boops. Sorry, I just can't do it. The boop boops are dumb. I laugh, but it's definitely at you, not with you.
Oh.
So much for my ever getting back invited back to one of your shows. Oh, so man. Just so you guys know, Mark Baker Wright is a buddy of mine. We've hung out many times at conventions, and I will tell you now what I call him in person, which is Mark Baker Wrong, because he is wrong. The boop, 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 boop is clearly been identified as a winner from most of you, so it will continue on, and Mark can just laugh at us as all he wants.
I think the boop boop thing is just pushing the comedy precept of like something's funny in the beginning, and then you keep doing it, and it stops being funny, and then you keep doing it past that, and then it becomes funny again.
I call it the David Letterman effect, but yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
Chris Mort says, another wonderful episode. I am always excited for new episodes from the Fire and Water Network.
Easy love for you to say.
Yeah. I love learning about such characters as Balloon Buster and Earth 2 Superman. Then to my horror, there's Evil Rob laughing at me and slandering my family's good name. Thank goodness for Shag coming to my defense. My hero. He, among others, like Chris and Cindy Franco, Michael Bailey, and only other great hosts, except that Rob guy, make this the best podcast network there is. Looking forward to all the great content. Keep up the great work. And remember, Morts are really badasses no matter what Rob Kelly says.
That's a hashtag, by the way.
Hashtag. So I responded, blame Wizard Magazine. To which Chris responded, blame an out-of-business magazine? No, sir, you perpetuate it. There was a time when there were words used in everyday society that are no longer used. Can't we make that one of those words? That's all I'm asking. But that's okay if you can't find it in your heart of hearts to do this for me, Rob. I'll understand. I'll still call you Evil Rob, but I'll understand.
It didn't just end here, by the way. This was on Facebook, too. Like, Chris and I are friends on Facebook, and he mentioned, like, hey, I mentioned in this episode. And then someone asked him why. And so he had to, like, explain the Mort thing. And he's, you know, oh, it's so funny. It cracks me up.
I'm sorry.
I don't think it's going away, Chris. Sorry, buddy. I will continue to stand up for your family's good name, but I don't think it's going anywhere. And it is kind of in the lexicon, buddy. I'm sorry. I really am.
I got it. What I'm picturing is kind of like the opening scene from The Godfather Part 2, where like Chris Mort's family from like many generations previous go to Ellis Island, and like their name was like Mortansky or something, and the guy in the booth just shortened it to Mort, not realizing that what he was sticking Chris with many generations later.
Gosh. All right. Moving on before Chris gets upset again. We heard from Diablo Frank, because that won't upset anybody, from the World Spine Podcasting Network. He has shows such as DC Secret Files podcast and more. He talks about the Manhunters, and he also agrees that martial law is what I always associate with Kevin O'Neill. He goes, at this time, the only thing Kevin O'Neill had any clear association was with the Green Lantern Corps. I had forgotten about that, which is right. And then I asked last episode, I don't know if you remember, Rob, but you don't listen to anything I say, but I had asked about Mark Shaw and the Star Czar and the Manhunters. Like I always said, like I feel like that was supposed to be like a big deal, because I remember reading about it all the time. And Frank actually hit it here on the nose. He goes, I suspect Shag's outsized opinion of the JLA Manhunters, Star Czar stuff comes from the prolonged Millennium exposure, including the Secret Origins tie-in and the Ostrander Rice Manhunter Mark Shaw series that followed it. Bang, you are dead on, Frank. It is the awful concoction of those things together. Secret Origins, which I loved, that Manhunter series, which I adored, and then Millennium. Yes, absolutely gave me this false impression of how important that storyline was. You're right. Well done, sir. You solved the mystery.
And that's the right term, exposure to Millennium.
I had to put a cream on it. Then about Atari Forces, we talked a little bit about there last time. He says, of course, Frank takes a contrary opinion. He goes, it's a perfectly decent Star Wars knockoff in the vein of Micronauts or Dreadstar, but not as good as either. Ooh, ouch. Okay. All right. Then we heard from Siskoid from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has shows such as Who's Editing, and Ohotmu or Not, and more. He says, Balloon Buster, where does the Owen Wilson casting come from? It sounds like the dumbass kind of thing the Hot Squad would come up with. Well, Siskoid, technically, to be scientific about it, the Owen Wilson casting comes from open your freaking eyes and look at the entry. Yeah, that's the scientific term for it. But anyway, then he says about Tarantula, because I had said that Tarantula looked like Dominic Fortune. He says it's appropriate to say that the Chaykin-esque costume recalls Dominic Fortune, but even more so the Scorpion, which Chaykin created for Atlas Comics, then ported over to Marvel with a name change. All right. Very interesting. Okay. And I didn't realize that the Scorpion was simply Dominic Fortune with a new name or vice versa, but that makes perfect sense. Then we're from Brian Schufo, who says, more randomized boops, please. Boop, 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 boop. That's just for you. That's a long distance dedication to you, Brian. And he says, even if someone has to do it from outside through the window, you can call it the boop window. And then he says, sorry, it's a holiday working. Sorry, it's a holiday weekend and I had extra time to really stretch out that bad joke. It says the tarantula redesign is one of my favorites. The original costume had that purple mask, which left the sideburn area on his face uncovered, which drives me crazy. How does that even stay on his head? I know the redesign foreshadows some of the worst costume choices of the 90s and is not appropriate for the 40s, but I still love it. Right there with you, Brian. Absolutely. Then Super Captain, he asks a really interesting question. He goes, there's a question concerning Dr. Light. He's one of the few villains who has a legacy character who is a hero in Kimio Hoshi. One of the others was also included in that episode was namely Brainwave, whose son, Brainwave Jr., became a member of Infinity Inc. That's the only one I can think of other than Brainiac, whose legacy eventually becomes Brainiac 5 of the Legion. Any others? And he says the spoiler does not count since it's a completely different identity from her father, Cluemaster. Good question, Super Captain. Martin Gray chimes in with, he goes, how about Harlequin 2, Duella Dent, daughter of Two-Face? She was a good gal. So that's one there. I thought on this for a while here, Super Captain, and I came up with a few more. So people that the namesake is a villain, but they used it the same name in a heroic fashion. There's the Toy Man in, again, that Superman, Batman, Public Enemy story by Jeff Loeb and Ed McGuinness. That was a teenage genius kid who helped Superman and Batman. So there you go. There's a Toy Man. Then there's Faust, who was the son of Felix Faust. He was heroic part of the Outsiders. Then there's Captain Boomerang. His son, Owen, was he sort of walked the line between good guy and bad guy, so he can kind of count. And then my last one, sort of a stretch, but the Huntress. Helena Wayne wasn't necessarily a legacy, but there was already an Earth 2 villain named the Huntress. So that's sort of retaking the name. She, of course, changed her name to Tigress later to avoid confusion. So there's a few. I would love to know if anyone else has any other where a villain name was used in a heroic capacity afterwards. Please share that in the comments.
I would not have even thought of that many examples.
Yeah.
Clinton Robinson from the Coffee and Comics blog says, love the randomizer. Play between every entry, but make Rob do it. I find my joy in hearing his happiness fade each time he has to make the noise. Okay, not really, but I do enjoy the randomizer noises very much. Jeez, I sent his wife a movie, too. That's what the thanks I get.
Hey, but no, last episode, I did listen back. You are going like, boop, 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 like purposely. So. Then we heard from Lizanne Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, Dr. Light is the replacement, wore it better, meaning the costume. It says, best memory I have of the original Dr. Light was when he was on the Suicide Squad and Boomer hit the whole team with pies in the face. Yes, that is a beloved Suicide Squad moment, Liz. Absolutely. And then regarding the Roving Ranger, Liz says, oi. Looks like someone's uncle got really drunk at a barbecue and picked up his old six shooters. A half plaid shirt? Oi, Captain Tacky here. All right.
Jeff Tischer brings up whatever happened to Balloon Buster. Not only was it established that Matt Savage / K. Wonote is his father, but Trail Boss Matt Savage is his grandfather. He has not been seen since Batman Legends of the Dark Knight Annual number 7 in 1997. I'm quite shocked he wasn't even mentioned in the new history of the DC Universe.
Well, here you go. I will say one thing. So in the new Superman movie, in the Hall of Justice, there is a mural along the roof line, okay?
Yep.
And the mural is a timeline. And when they get to about the World War One era, there is a biplane in that mural. I'm calling it now. That's Balloon Buster, by golly, because it's not red. It's not the enemy ace. It's Balloon Buster. So there, he was in a movie, as far as I'm concerned. So, all right. It was Owen Wilson, drawn very small. Anyway, then about Dr. Light, he says during. So I mentioned earlier, Dr. Light. I mentioned that Kimio and apparently Arthur Light were married. He explains it here, and it ends well. So, during the New 52, it was established that Arthur Light was a small-time criminal who used his tech to commit crimes. He eventually gave it up and married Kimio Hoshi, the superheroic Dr. Light, and they had three kids. After he retired, he was recruited as a scientist for Argus, where he accidentally gained the ability to drain energy. Amanda Waller offered him a deal to join her new team, the Justice League of America, and help her take down the other Justice League, or he can rot in a cell. He joined and tried his best to resist Waller, but during the beginning of the Trinity War, he involuntarily triggered Superman's heat vision and was incinerated by it. There's your happy ending. Dr. Light burned to a crisp and dead. I like that. Then regarding Nelson Strong and the Adventures Club, more, I mean, that thing was a hit, man. There's a lot of information out there. It says Strong was last seen in the pages of Swamp Thing Volume 2 when he was hired by the Clinton administration to hunt down and stop the Swamp Thing. He died in a pitched battle against Swamp Thing in the streets of Amsterdam. Among his trophies were heads and taxidermied bodies of various creatures throughout the DC universe, including a Manhawk, a gorilla from Gorilla City, a chemo body, a shaggy man body, the head of
Abnegazar.
Thank you. From the Demon 3, a head of Ultivac, a GI robot head, a Medusa, a patchwork man, and a werewolf. That's really cool. That's pretty awesome.
I got to read that. That sounds really cool.
It does. It
that
does.
That really sounds fantastic. I got to check that out. He also says, hey, Rob, I checked all my font sources, my personal library, dafont.com, what the font, Adobe fonts, etc. And I wasn't able to come up with a good match for the Manhunters logo. This is clearly a handcrafted font from back in the day when designers and artists still had the luxury of time to do this sort of work. It would be awesome to expand this into a full font set, but creating typography is not my forte. It's a beautiful logo, though the kerning difference between the MA and NH drives me batty. I hear that, Jeff, and I appreciate the legwork of looking into it. I would have loved to have that as a font. That'd be cool.
That's amazing amount of, and Jeff's always famous for his research, but that's, that's amazing. Yep. They were here for Simple Penning from the Power Girl blog, Simple Penning. He says, whilst I'm not calling your randomizer into question, it is strange that you just happen to include a character from the issue number 58 of All-Star Comics. Of course, as well as giving the Brainwave redesign and making Roy Thomas happy again, it also gives us the triumphant return of the Star-Spangled Kid. Oh, and also some new character, although I'm sure no one would be interested in here. Well, Symbol Pending, the randomizer paid off for you in a big way this episode, so I hope you enjoyed it, and I expect to see some comments.
Mm-hmm. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says that Rob is right. The post-crisis Superman was born on Earth One Bit is a terrible idea.
Oh.
You see, he can have our world as his home, but not having had his ickle feet so much as touch Kryptonian soil is awful. Rob, Pluggy McPlugface has to be a reference to Bodie McBoatface. Did you hear about that in the U.S.? Just in case anyone hasn't heard from Wiki. The story of Bodie McBoatface began with a public poll run by the Natural Environment Research Council to name their new polar research ship. The name Bodie McBoatface became a viral sensation and received the most votes, far surpassing other suggestions. However, NERC ultimately decided to name the ship after Sir David Attenborough, a renowned naturalist and broadcaster, as a more fitting tribute to his contributions to science. As a compromise, they decided to name one of the ship's submersibles Bodie McBoatface. Love, love, love the randomizer noise. It's up there with Shazam and the Whip.
This is the most random feedback episode we've ever done. Like, Bodie McBoatface has nothing to do with any of this, anything.
Well,
because
I said the Pluggy McPlugface, which it was. It was a direct reference to Bodie McBoatface.
Oh my gosh, that is hysterical. I'd never heard that story. Okay. Then we heard from, I believe, a new commenter. I'm not entirely sure. Sydney Sapper Osinga. I don't remember them before, and they've got a lot of feedback here. Just a couple of the comments. Brainwave Sr., it was cool that he sacrificed himself to save his son. A type of redemption not often seen in villains. That's great observation. Then they say about Manhunters, they have a special place in my heart due to me picking up the back issues of Millennium and its crossovers back when I started collecting comics. O'Neill also did the entry for the Spider Guild, which was connected to both the Green Lantern Corps and the Omega Men, which he did backups for Alan with Alan Moore. They were from Mike Cole. Says, you guys should check out the new history of the DC Universe. It feels like it was made for fans of the original Who's Who. It goes chronologically through the DC history, spotlighting all the characters from the different eras. It includes some characters from more recent storylines, but most of them are classic characters from DC's publishing history as seen in Who's Who, plus the outstanding art by Todd Nuck and Jerry the Extraordinary Ordway. Mike, I got to tell you, I have read the first issue of the new history of the DC Universe, and I loved every single freaking panel. It was wonderful. I've got issue 2 lined up to read on DC Infinite. I can't wait to get into it. I just haven't had a chance yet. So, yeah, I'm loving it, man. Fantastic series. Then we're from John Stibe. John Stibe is always nice enough to promote our show. So this is what he said to promote it last time. He says, it's the last day of June and the perfect opportunity to dig out your Who's Who comics and follow along with Robin Shag as they remind us why Balloon Buster and Captain Fear are two characters you need to learn more about. It's so fun so far, and it makes me want to read comics featuring those two characters in particular. Plus, Rob's take on the randomizer makes me chuckle each time. Thanks for your efforts. I continue to find my joy. Well, thanks, John.
That's great. Great review. Thank you.
All right, now this is the part of the show where we read all of your names for those folks who shared our show on the social media timelines. These come from Facebook and Blue Sky. Yes, I know it sounds like a long list of names, like I'm reading a phone book of weird handles, but we want to recognize each person that helps promote the show. Thank you so much, because each and every one of you folks that help promote the show are an important part of the Who's Who podcast community, and you help us grow. So
you've come this far.
Right, exactly, right. So apologies to anyone we may have missed. So our thanks go out to A World on Fire and All-Star Squadron Podcast, Al Girding, Alan Boyce Jr., Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer, Billy D., Brent Young, Brian Schufo, Chris A. Field, Chris Franklin, Chris Mort, Christopher Hamby, Chuck Bushman, Coffee and Comics, David A. Gutierrez, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank, Dr. Ange, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Eddie Schmitz, Isamu Hideaki Yukinori, Jeff Weinberg, JLA Stories and Friends, John Ryan, John Stibe, Kichi Baker, Connell, Lizanne Oswald,
Lucien Dizar, Mark Baker Wrong, Martin Gray, Max Romero, Max Traver, Mike Jameson, Monitor Earth Prime, Movie Matt Royce, Outcasters, A Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Paul Ken, Peace Bound and Down, A Wonder Woman Podcast, Prayer of Justice, The Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Oh, get out of that. Robert Gross, S. Matthew Stolt, Scott X, Sean Ross, Slangword Scott, Steve Givens, Superman Radio Revisited, Symbol Pending, Teal Productions, Tim Price, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Willie Yarborough, and Zeb Oswald.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for sharing those out. We sincerely appreciate it. And please, again, get out there and share the show on your social media to really to grow the community. It would be great. We really appreciate it. So that's going to do it. Until next time, it looks like, Rob, our next episode is going to be in November.
Okay. I think
right after Thanksgiving, actually. So gobble, gobble.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Oh, yeah. With that, I had a blast. This was so much fun. It was a great way to wind up the week. So thank you for doing this, Rob. I had a good time.
It's always fun. Always fun doing these. So, yeah, it was a great time.
All right, folks. Well, until next time,
who's next? Next.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Aw, man. We forgot Slipknot.
Coming from the farthest reaches of the universe to challenge the worst villains on Earth are the most powerful heroes ever in the Battle of the Superpowers Collection. Can it be the Supermobile on the attack? The Lexor 7 armed with kryptonite? Will the Supermobile repel those deadly rays?
You bet.
Ready for battle? Activate RAM!
New from Kenner's Superpowers Collection. Vehicles and figures with power action, each sold separately. Flying lessons for Penguin, fish bait for Luther. Can the Supermobile defeat the Lexor 7? You decide.